the author of the new study on the cost of segregation, Alden Lowery, MMA championship fighter King Mo, and Chicago author Donna Seaman. And now here's your host, a man who just followed Kristen Cavallari on Instagram, Justin Kaufman.
Why not, right? It's good. It's a lot of scenery, a lot of landscape. Good evening, everybody. It's the download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman, and in the chair, it's 11 o'clock tonight. I'm honored that you would ride shotgun with me, or vice versa, tonight, as we have one of the most eclectic shows in the history of the of the download, which is saying a lot. If you listen to this program on the regular, you know that we can get very, we can go off in a lot of different ways, you know, not always sort of talking politics or sports, but we can find a way to weave them all together, and tonight is no different. What a show! Coming up this hour, 7:30, right after the news, Alden Lowery is going to join us. He's one of the co-authors of the new Metropolitan Planning Council's new study on the cost of segregation. You may have seen this in the newspaper today. It's all over the place. The study was announced, released today. Alden will be in studio. We talked about this, last year, 2016. We had the Metropolitan Planning Council in, and we talked about just sort of when they were going to do this and putting it out and the idea that they were putting this together. It'll be interesting to read the findings, and the quick takeaway is it costs a lot. That's essentially the takeaway. Alden will be in after 7:30. Coming up in the 8 o'clock hour, my guest at the big table. This is going to be fun. I'm very excited about this. From mixed martial arts champion, King Mo, will be in studio as we talk about his big fight this weekend at Bellator, which is the Bellator MMA League, which is at the Allstate Arena. It'll be Friday night. Very excited to have King Mo in studio to talk about his career in and outside the cage. It's cage. You know, there's a lot of mixed martial arts that can happen in rings, but the style at Bellator is cage.
Is it still called a bout? Is it a bout?
I guess it's a match.
A match.
But it's not the sort of, you know, over-the-top WrestleMania kind of cage that you have to climb up to the top.
Mm-hmm.
But it's the ring that you see in Ultimate Fighting where it's like almost like chicken wire.
Yeah.
You know, but it is, it's they are turning the Allstate Arena into a set of center stage, center cage. King Mo. Big matchup. Heavyweight matchup. So he'll be in studio tonight, my guest at the big table. Also coming up tonight, like I said, very eclectic. We continue. Donna Seaman, longtime editor of Booklist. She is the author of Identity Unknown, Rediscovering Seven American Women Artists. Quick, Pete, name a woman artist.
Frida Kahlo.
All right. Good. We're on our way. Number two. Can you do a second? This is interesting. I mean, this is something I hadn't thought about. I did the same game at my desk, and I was like, okay, Gertrude Stein. And then I was like, it falls off a cliff. And it's not because there's only been two women artists in the history of art history. There is a serious gap in the identities and the recognition of women artists. The reason it says the book is called Identities Unknown is because Donna looked into some old paintings and things like that, and they'd always be like, there's this male artist, the woman on the end, identity unknown. There's a real sort of just, it's very, I would say, very dark history to sort of limiting the names and accolades and everything else that come to with female artists. So we'll talk with Donna Seaman about the seven artists that she profiles in her new book. It's fascinating. Good conversation coming up at 9 o'clock. We'll also switch gears. That should be the name of tonight's show. And we'll talk about the Chicago hot dog. Monica Eng in studio. And we'll play the worst tonight as well. CIF, Chicago Improv Festival in town. Holly Laurent will be here. Longtime Second City main stage cast member. She's now out in Los Angeles back for the Improv Festival. And she's going to play the worst with us. News, weather, and traffic with Rob Martier and Esmeralda Leon. Production provided by Pete Zimmerman. I'm Justin Kaufman, and this is The Download a show about Chicago starring those who know it well. We'll take a break. We'll come back. We'll do the carryout. Stay with us. That's a download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman, getting ready to kick off the download here. We got a huge show, so let's get at it. It's time for the carryout. This is, of course, our nightly segment where I read the news. So you at home, you don't have to. Here today's top stories, a soap opera called The House Intelligence Committee continues today as a planned meeting to hear the testimony of former Attorney General Sally Yates and former CIA Director John Brennan was canceled. This after both spoke publicly about their testimony and how it would contradict with the White House. The Washington Post is reporting that the White House went out of their way to keep Yates from testifying, although the White House says that's false. Dun, dun, dun! Tune in next week to the HIC when the eye patch doctor returns from the dead to say he's having an affair with the mayor's wife. Ah! I mean, the theatrics around this story, it's crazy. It's like a soap opera with hashtags. Hashtag sad. Hashtag Bill and Hillary did worse. That's my favorite part of it. Oh, boy. President Trump signed an executive order rolling back former President Obama's regulations on climate change and the environment. The Clean Power Plan was enacted to cut carbon emissions by 30% by 2030. To be fair, the plan was never put in place because of legal objections. It's still hung up in the courts, but the goal was to get the U.S. to comply with international rules as dictated by the Paris Climate Change meeting. Now, there are questions on whether or not the U.S. will withdraw from that deal and if this administration will care at all about the planet. Still up in the air. This, of course, will be fought in courts as well as 23 states have already joined on to take this on. Trump ran on the idea of bringing back big coal, so this isn't surprising. Also, kids, if you're paying attention, business first, everything else second. Now on to chapter two, how to hide your hair plugs. The Democrats responded to this move saying, what? Seriously? As they slid back in their high back chairs and continued to play words with friends. Oh, 50-point word. Leadership. Hillary Clinton made a speech today in San Francisco. No. Nope. Pass. Pass. We're not doing that. Illinois candidate for governor Chris Kennedy was asked how important it was to get the endorsement of the state's Democratic Party. He said it wasn't really that important. What's more important is the endorsements of people on Facebook and LinkedIn or Twitter and Snapchat. Really? So you mean likes? You're just pandering for likes? Any kind? The wow face, the sad face, the heart, anything? An endorsement on LinkedIn? Hey, Dave's endorsed Chris Kennedy for having great government skills. Or Snapchat? Oh, I love Chris Kennedy and this dog sticker face proves it. And now it's gone. Speaker Madigan and Governor Rauner are fighting over the sale of the Thompson Center. Madigan says he's willing to sell the building, even though Rauner says he's not willing to sell the building fast enough. Leave it up to Illinois lawmakers to argue about who wants to sell the building more. The building, of course, a local treasure just because it was the finale of the movie Running Scared, where Gregory Hines and Billy Crystal play tough Chicago cops trying to take down a Jimmy Smith's run cocaine cartel. Hines rappels down the inside of the building while shooting his Uzi. Just for that reason alone, no one should sell this building. They should make it a museum for Running Scared. For Michael McDonald's song, Shine Sweet Freedom, shine a light on me. Da, da, da. I don't know if you remember that song. In weather, it's pretty normal. If it's this cold in 2 weeks, we'll talk. In sports, hard to believe that we're just a mere 5 days away from opening day. The Cubs take on the Cardinals on Sunday night, and it looks more and more like Kyle Schwarber is going to be the leadoff man, not a pipe dream. He's been holding down the top spot all spring. No big injuries, although keep an eye on Addison Russell, who they say will be ready for opening day. Also, today marked the end of the Munenori Kawasaki era in Chicago. Kawasaki was supposed to bring the fun and flavor to the squad, but he barely made it up to the bigs. So, and you know what? You really don't need a goofball when you're winning championships. That's for a third-place team, to be fair. Anyway, seems ready. Team seems ready. Now we hope that Wrigley will be. Have you seen Wrigleyville lately? Just covered in one big blue construction tarp. Yikes. On the south side, the Sox traded center fielder Peter Borjos to the Rays, prompting the question, we had Peter Borjos? That was... The bigger question is, who plays center come opening day with rookie Charlie Tilson on the DL? Could be Jacob May, the rookie and nephew of former Sox great Carlos May. Why not? While we're at it, does Ron Karkovice have a kid who can catch? Maybe? Or how about Tommy Paturek? Maybe a grandson with skills to turn two at second base? No Lamar Hoyt relative in the old pipeline? Nothing? The Blackhawks are in Pittsburgh tomorrow night. 7 games left, 8-point lead. Should we be worried that they've lost 2 in a row? No. Let's just get this season over with, shall we? Let's get to the playoffs. And for the Bulls, they play next on Thursday against the Cavaliers, who are slumping. They might not even get the number one seed as Boston has moved ahead in the standings. The Bulls are a half game out of the playoffs right now with 8 games to go. And finally, the internet is ablaze with news of Jay Cutler. Wait, he signed somewhere? No. That's crazy. No, his wife took a picture of his naked bum and put it on Instagram, essentially saying, "Who needs football? We're available for reality television or softcore entertainment." Although right after the picture was taken, Cutler threw his butt into double coverage. Okay, whatever. That's the carryout for March 28th, 2017. I can't remember how many drinks you ordered, but here's a couple extra straws. You know, save them for the next time. That button double coverage joke looked better on paper. Coming up, the cost of segregation. Alden Laurie will be here, one of the co-authors of the MPC study that was put out today. And King Mo in studio at the big table to talk MMA at 8 o'clock. It's a download on 720 WGN. Stay with us. Rob Marks here. How are you, my man?
Oh, man, I am a huge MMA fan.
Really? Do you know King Mo?
I know of King Mo, yes.
He is a champion, and he's also, this is interesting, you'll love this. He wants to rematch with Rampage Jackson.
Mm-hmm.
But Rampage Jackson in the last 2 or 3 years since they fought last time has changed weight classes. So he has actually, you know, done the waiver to say, I don't care about weight, I want to fight him, even though now he's outweighed by 30, 40 pounds.
My money's on Big Mo.
Yeah.
And not just because he's sitting in the studio and could crush me like a tin can.
I hope he brings his crown. That's all I care about. Thanks, Rob. It's a download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman with you till 11 o'clock tonight. Coming up at 8 o'clock at the big table, King Mo, the MMA fighter, will be in studio. We'll talk about MMA and his life. Making a transition from a U.S. Nationals team wrestler to a mixed martial artist. So we'll talk about that coming up here in the 8 o'clock hour. But first, lost income, lost lives, and lost potential. These are some of the categories explored in today's Metropolitan Planning Council study on the cost of segregation. The MPC has been working on this study for years. We talked about it back in 2016. Today, it was released. So what's it say? Well, it says we're paying a ton to live separately. One of the co-authors is Alden Laurie, the Director of Research and Evaluation for the Metropolitan Planning Council. Alden, great to see you.
Justin, great to see you.
All right, so let's get into this. This is a big story today. It was all over the papers. You guys released it. You know, this was something you guys have been working on for a while. You know, I kind of, you know, tongue-in-cheek say we're paying a ton, but really that is the finding.
Indeed. And essentially what we've done is we partnered with the Urban Institute. Conversation started literally, you know, about 2 years ago. And it started with two questions. The premise that while we may believe that segregation, we know it's been with us, particularly here in Chicago, we know that it's been a particular problem for our city and to some extent to our region. And I think the thinking is, for many people, is segregation is really hurting people of color, poor people. You know, those are the people who are really losing out. We started this research with the premise and the thought that, well, are we missing the boat there? Is segregation really having an impact on all of us? Are we as a region being hurt by that?
And this study is not about how it's impacting just one part of segregation.
No,
it's
not
the full. It's how it affects us as a city.
Exactly. And so we contracted with the Urban Institute to actually do the empirical research. And what Urban did was they measured segregation for the 100 largest metros in the nation, for economic segregation, and for racial segregation between African-Americans and whites and between Latinos and whites. Then they also looked at a host of quality of life indicators, if you will, income, life expectancy, homicide rate, and bachelor's degree attainment, mm-hmm, for all of these metros. And it did a regression analysis, holding steady for some control variables, which include the size of population, manufacturing jobs, and other things that they believe to be associated or could be associated with segregation. And what they came up with was three statistically significant findings, which we share in our report. And the Urban Institute released a report themselves, which is an academic report, which goes much more into detail about a national scope and also about their methodology and things of that nature. Our report, we mimic Urban's numbers. We report the numbers that they found for Chicago in particular, and then we added a few numbers of our own based on supplemental research that was done and some analysis that we've done. So what's the cost?
Yeah.
What we say is that, and we express the cost essentially by looking at where the levels of segregation are in Chicago, in the Chicago region, and what and that impact on those indicators, and what those indicators would look like in the Chicago region if the Chicago region's level of segregation were at the median.
Got it. Yep.
What Urban found was a statistically significant relationship between black-white segregation and per capita black income. Generally speaking, as the levels of black-white segregation rise, when you look across these 100 metros, you see the level of black income, per capita income, decrease. So essentially, when African Americans live in less segregated regions, they earn more per person. And so when we apply that to Chicago, where the ranking for black-white segregation was 10th in the nation, and we look at where Chicago could be if it were at the median, essentially between 50 and 51, right in the middle, we find that African Americans, generally speaking, would earn about $3,000 more per person. And that's, again, because when we look at those median metros, those metros that are at the median for black-white segregation, African Americans are earning
more than they are in Chicago. So you could take away from the report that if segregation wasn't at the levels that it is in Chicago, if it were lower, that there is a $3,000 discrepancy for someone who African American making the same or doing the same job as someone who's white.
Yeah, and I'm saying earnings, and we're technically talking about per capita income. So this is per person. So we're talking about people who
are billions of dollars, but you're right.
$4.4 billion overall for the Chicago region. And when you look at that, so you say, okay, great. African Americans would be making more money in Chicago if segregation were lower. But, you know, there's an actual impact to the entire region as a result of that. Now, that $4.4 billion is money that would be used in the economy here. And when we see a boost of that level to the economy in income, we think that translates to an $8 billion boost to the gross domestic product.
How does that apply? I mean, I know the Institute did the work on it, but how does that play out in the sense that, I mean, is it hard to prove that because, you know, there are communities that live segregated from other communities that if they weren't, if everybody lived on the same block and everyone lived in the same neighborhood, you'd be able to see a marked difference in income?
And the struggle with a study like this, or really with any study, is that term prove.
Right.
And so, you know, you can get very close with empirical research like this. You can control for a lot of factors, but we can't necessarily say definitively that A causes B. We can't necessarily say that levels of segregation cause the income of African Americans to decline or increase. You know, there's just no way to really kind of add all of the variables that could possibly be at play. But what they've done is they've made a very reasonable guess, if you will, about the impact. And what they found is that, and I'm getting a little bit into statistical speak here, but to the 90% confidence level, what they're saying is that the relationship that they see, you know, they're 90% certain based on this research that that's not caused by some randomness or coincidence. Like, there is actually a relationship. It may not necessarily be a causal relationship, but we can't say that it's not a causal relationship. What we can say is that these two variables are intrinsically related to one another, and there's some level of influence. And so based on that, they say we can presume that the level of black income would be higher in the Chicago region if its levels of black-white segregation were lower, because when we look at other metros,
that's what we see. Is it one affects the other, meaning the $4.4 billion? Is it $4.4 billion that's would be added to African-American salaries? Is that taken from somewhere else, or is the idea that that would just be an add plus? Does that make sense?
This is one of the struggles with this kind of research. So the research is telling us the what and not necessarily the why. I mean, you know, so I would be speculating to say why that difference happens. But I do think that this is just kind of based on some knowledge of the way our particular region is kind of put together. When you look at it's essentially the very densely populated parts of the Chicago region that are predominantly African-American, you see a lot of struggles.
Right.
And that's not to say that that's the only things that are happening there, but there are a number of struggles there. And so there's an impact, I think, that carries weight in those regions, regardless of what the individual person in those in individual people in those regions are doing. So case in point, I live on the south side of Chicago, working, you know, doing relatively well for myself. My home, the home that I live in, the home that I bought, is extremely undervalued. And a big part of the reason why is because of where I live,
right,
and the character of that neighborhood and the character that is at least perceived about that neighborhood. Because you can actually go into some spaces in Black Chicago and you might expect one thing and you'll find something completely different.
And you, Alden, I mean, from your days at the Chicago Reporter or even the Better Government Association, this has been something that has been historical in Chicago. The fact that there have been properties that have been undervalued or areas of Chicago because of the ethnicity, automatically the property values are lower. I mean, this is inherent to Chicago, not just Chicago, any urban setting or
city. Right.
So how do you separate sort of the fact that that's sort of a well-known entity, meaning that, you know, I guess it would be casual or, you know, unscientific, to the fact that this is now pointing to the fact that quality of life and the idea of property or values of those properties is actually is a cost to the city of Chicago.
I mean, I think intuitively we know this. I mean, those of us who, you know different parts of the city relatively well, we know this. We at least, even if we can't necessarily articulated, and that's what the study was meant to do, to try to give us at least some idea of what this is costing us. And so the research gives us a number, and again, you can pick and play with that number and attack the methodology and all of that to some degree, and that's fine. But the numbers give us, I think, a solid at least ballpark figure of what this is costing us. And again, it's based on research looking across the nation, many similar metro areas to Chicago, and this is what we see. And so this is what the Urban Institute is suggesting.
Yeah.
And that's just one of the findings, you know, just to quickly get through the other two major findings. They're also showing that there is a connection between black-white segregation and the level of homicides. And so essentially, if, again, the level of black-white segregation in the Chicago region were to drop to the median, what we'd see is a 30% fewer homicides in the Chicago region. And just for example, the city of Chicago, 760 plus homicides in 2016, the most in literally, you know, 20 years. And we're talking about 229 fewer murders if you apply that 30% reduction.
That's a huge reduction, yeah.
And there's an economic cost to that as well. Supplemental research that we looked at from the Center for American Progress shows that in research that they did on the Chicago region and seven other metros, is that every time you have an additional homicide in a zip code, you essentially see a 1.5% reduction in the residential property values in those zip codes. And that's regardless of whether you have 30 murders or three murders. And so this is a detriment to any part of the region, regardless of how safe or violent those regions are. And so, again, when we say that there is a cost overall, there's a cost overall. And even though when people think about the problems of homicides in Chicago, they may say, well, that's really only happening here.
Yeah, it's not my problem right now, right?
But what we're saying is that the region as a whole suffers because of, you know, generally speaking, that stigma of the Chicago region, people outside of the Chicago region, maybe even outside of the city, they don't understand necessarily the problems of Englewood as compared to the problems of Lincoln Park or what have you. People in Buffalo or in New York City or whatever, and they're thinking about Chicago, and is Chicago a place to locate their business? Is Chicago a place to come visit? Is Chicago a place to visit for a convention or something like that, or a place to move your family? They're going to listen to those stories.
Right,
and
so
that's also something in
that's
a way
impact
that the region is impacted.
Let's talk about
it.
The third category.
The third category is looking at the level of bachelor's degrees that are attained. And what the Urban Institute found was that as the levels of black-white segregation, again, as levels of black-white segregation increase, you see a decline in the levels of bachelor's degrees attained by both whites and African-Americans.
Huh.
And so this is one finding that is particular to whites that I think was a surprise to some degree, but we thought was imperative for us to mention as to articulate that this is a very broad cause to segregation. And actually, the impact is greater on whites. 78% of those 83,000 bachelor's degrees that we would see in the Chicago region, if we were to fall to the median of black-white segregation, would be bachelor's degrees for whites, 22% bachelor's degrees for African-Americans. And again, again, and that's looking at the way Urban has articulated that, is that if we were at the median for black-white segregation right. in 2000, by 2010, a decade later, we would have 83,000 more
fascinating.
People with bachelor's
the whole study
degrees
is,
in the region.
The whole study, the Metropolitan Planning Council study on the cost of segregation is amazing. It's out now. One of the co-authors, Alden Lowry, in studio, is Director of Research and Evaluation for the MPC. Last question, just what's next? I mean, you put this out. You've been working on this for 2 years. I mean, are you guys tasked with ending segregation? Is that the idea? The next study is to move towards how we're going to see a future of the city of Chicago?
Well, the next step for us is taking a look at what can we reasonably do to address segregation. And I think that, you know, from the outset, we certainly know that we're not going to cure segregation. Segregation is something that is probably always going to be with us. I would say certainly it is always going to be with us. But are there ways we can see improvements? And we think from the results of the first study that we can find some objectives that can actually make progress. Because we've seen progress happen. Atlanta, for us, has become a key example. Their black-white segregation ranking fell from 21st in 1990 to 41st in 2010. And in that time, it's roughly a 40% reduction in their measurement of black-white segregation. So something's happened in the Atlanta metro area that we really want to take a closer look at and figure out.
Well, you guys
and
are
even,
on it. Yeah.
Even Chicago has seen a minor reduction in its level of black-white segregation by a much lower percent, 10%. And so we want to even take a closer look at what's happened locally to figure out, okay, what kinds of things have we done? In what areas have we seen changes happen? And is there something we can learn from that we can maybe expand upon and do more of?
Alden Lowry, Director of Research and Evaluation for the Metropolitan Planning Council, put out the study today on the cost of segregation. Alden, great combo. Great to see you, and I can't wait to continue this conversation with you in months to come.
Same here. Let's do it, man.
Thanks, Rob. It's Download here, 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, coming up, we're going to talk with MMA fighter King Mo. He's got a big event, a big fight on Friday at the Allstate Arena. James Hirth joins me in studio right now. He's a reporter who covers MMA and combat sports. Joins us regularly on the Download. Great to see you, James. How are you?
Great to be here. Thank you.
All right, so, you know, before we get to King Mo, who's going to be in studio, you know, this is a big deal. Bellator 175. Talk about this company, because this is something I don't know a lot. And I've said this before when you and I talk. I don't know the first thing about mixed martial arts or combat sports. It's like one of the things that I want to learn more about. So where does Bellator fit in when we talk about mixed martial arts?
Well, Bellator is the number two dog. We all know who the number one dog is. So Bellator is right there. And they've really matured as an organization, much like a fighter, one that, you know, develops themselves. They've grown as a company. Started in 2008, actually with an office here in Chicago, and did some work on some small cable stations, you know, to grow their brand. Moved over to Spike in 2013, right around that time. They originally had a tournament format, which is kind of the old school way to do it. Now they have their own champions, their own weight divisions, you know, all of that.
Right.
Even with the tournaments, there were champions, but they've kind of adapted and grown and evolved.
Well,
into
almost like they've
a
turned
Premier
into like
League.
A wrestling, like we'd know of boxing and wrestling, right?
Correct.
Yeah.
So, and they are, you know, at one point in time, it was kind of the promotion that was growing. So fighters maybe who are a little past their prime would go to Bellator, but now they have top flight talent. They can command, you know,
how many leagues are there when we talk about this? What are the ones that, I mean, are we talking 10, 15? What are the most influential leagues in MMA?
If you can kind of look at it like the NFL. Okay, so the NFL is obviously the big dog. There's the Canadian Football League, and there's some other leagues. Mm-hmm. Same with MMA. Really, in the United States, there's two major promotions. What happened was the king dog, without, you know, the elephant in the room, the UFC, kind of swallows up its competition. There's a number of promotions that they kind of just ate. Rather than compete against them, they
just absorb them, right?
They just absorb them. Yeah.
Right.
Well, and they gut them. They kind of took all the athletes out of it. Bellator has been able to remain on their own and compete with the UFC as far as athletes go. So really, as far as the major organizations in the United States, it's the UFC and Bellator.
And it's interesting, too, because when we talk, and we'll talk with King Mo coming up here in just a moment, you know, and you think about Rampage Jackson and some of the other fighters that are in Bellator, these are top-level fighters. These are fighters you could see in other places. They've been offered contracts other places. Why does a fighter choose Bellator if they can fight in other places or go to the WWE and do wrestling? What is it about Bellator that brings these fighters to them?
A few things. One might be the freedom of fighting for sometimes other promotions and things like that. With UFC, a lot of times you're locked into a contract. You can only fight for that organization. You can only carry the sponsors that are approved by the UFC. They own, you know, your likeness. You know, there's a lot of things that are very, very controlling organization. And not to say that Bellator doesn't have its own, you know, level of requirements, but there is a certain level of freedom in that organization. They also present more opportunities in that they do have kickboxing. So they run regular kickboxing shows if that's something you want to do. They have partnered with some other organizations. There's a big event in Japan called Ryzen. It used to be the major event, probably the best MMA event in the world, used to be called Pride, the Pride Fighting Championships. And Pride is no longer here. The UFC bought it and gutted it, and it is no more.
Right.
But Japan is a stronghold of MMA. They love their fighting sports.
When you talk about a Bellator and its relationship with Spike, I mean, Spike TV obviously giving it a platform that you know an audience can find at a certain level. Talk about that. Talk about how important it is for any sort of mixed martial arts company, promotion, to have a broadcast partner.
Oh, absolutely. Because you need that platform of competition. And again, it's think about someone trying to compete with the NFL in a pro football setting. Virtually impossible. Where's all the money? You know what I mean? We know, you know, where that's going. So to have a partner like Spike, to have a weekly, monthly platform to show your stars and grow your brand, what could be better?
How often does Bellator or UFC, how often do they get through Chicago? I mean, when you think about the big, because they're playing Allstate Arena, which is a big deal. I mean, that's a huge venue for this kind of event. How often do you see these leagues, these promotions come through this area?
Unfortunately, it's only like on an annual basis. UFC is likely once a year in Chicago. Bellator, I think, has been away maybe for 7 years. I think they've only been here like three times, you know, which is odd, just that they had a home base here. Right. But yeah, they haven't been here in a while. This is a big card, though, with some quality fighters and some local talent, which is also good. And that's another benefit to having a big show is obviously they need to feed, you know, fill in the early bouts, the undercard. They use a lot of local talent. So guys that maybe wouldn't get a chance, maybe they're fighting in Indiana or Iowa, you know, on some small show, you know, just to get some experience. Well, maybe if you know you get that phone call, you get to fight on the Bellator undercard that's going to be shown on Spike.
That's right.
You know,
Friday,
it's a big deal.
At the Allstate Arena here in the Chicago area. Okay, we'll take a quick break. We'll come back. King Mo in studio. We'll talk with the champ about his life in MMA and wrestling and what makes him tick inside and outside the cage. James Hirth, of course, a regular here on The Download who covers MMA and combat sports. We'll take a quick break. King Mo coming up. Stay with us.
I'm King Mo like heavyweight champ. Like crazy, you took out in the first round. Like Marcellus, Mario Nudnick.
All right, this Friday night, the Allstate Arena center stage will be transformed into the center cage as the Bellator 175 comes to town, presented by Spike. Bellator, of course, one of the premier MMA leagues around. The heavyweight main event is a highly anticipated rematch between Rampage Jackson and my guest tonight, King Mo. King Mo, also known as Muhammad Lawal, is a mixed martial artist who's a former champion in other leagues. But he got his start as a wrestler in high school in Plano, Texas, and after that was a Big 12 champion in his weight class when at Oklahoma State. He wrestled for the U.S. national team, and he moved to mixed martial arts in 2008, and he is my guest tonight in studio. King Mo, pleasure to meet you. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me, man. Appreciate it.
And James Hirth, of course, a regular sticking around to ride shotgun tonight.
Thank you. Let me ask you,
I'm fascinated. I mean, we were just talking about Bellator doesn't come to Chicago that often. For you to have this opportunity for this highly anticipated rematch to happen in a big city in Chicago, what's it mean to you as a mixed martial artist, but also as a wrestler, as a kid who has always sort of, you know, been ready for the stage?
You know, one thing I like about Chicago is I had a wrestling match here man, years ago. It was the Team USA versus Russia. And I came here, and I was the only person to win, you know what I'm saying? So Chicago holds a good place in my heart, you know. And They have a team called the Harvey Twisters. They showed me a lot of love out of Harvey, Illinois. But for Bellator to come to Chicago, it kind of legitimizes Bellator even more. Because before, when Bellator first started, when I first got involved in Bellator, we were going to rinky-dink, you know, cities like Thackerville, Oklahoma, and Mulvane, Kansas, and just places you never heard of.
Right.
And now we're growing, we're bigger. We got Scott Coker on as the president. We're going to, we came to Chicago, and it shows that we're you know, coming to the top.
It's a, I mean, it's quite a career arc. And I think about this, you know, we'll talk about your, what to expect from the fight this weekend. But for you, as I mentioned, I mean, a wrestler in high school, wrestler in college, yeah. You know, and I thought about it, and I guess it never occurred to me that a lot of wrestlers who spent their time, you know, working in non-professional situations, whether high school, Olympics, national team, that kind of stuff. You know, when they're done wrestling, when their time is up and they have to go pro is could be mixed martial arts.
Yeah, pro is mixed martial arts pretty much. You know, when I was wrestling, we got paid $1,000 to win tournaments, $1,500 to win nationals. We go to overseas to Turkey or I mean to Iran, Azerbaijan. We win tournaments there. We might get $3,000 cash on the stand, maybe $4,000, and then Team USA would match it. So we got paid to win, and then once it's all said and done, like there's no income coming in from nowhere. So you're like, when I was done wrestling, I was broke. I couldn't afford to even pay for my bags to fly to my fight in Japan. It was tough. So I just
what were your options? What were you thinking?
I could go back to wrestling and coach and make $1,000 a month, if that, or I could fight. You know, or I could try to get a normal job and work my way from the bottom to the top, but that time I was 28 years old and I wasn't trying to start from the bottom again because I did that in wrestling. So I just took, you know, started training. After 6 weeks of training, took my first fight on a week's notice in Japan. Fought that and won, and here I am.
Unfortunately, wrestling is one of the sports that the professional level is considered kind of a joke. You know what I mean? When you look at professional wrestling, when somebody says that, you know, they think of something that's staged. You know, when you do professional football or professional baseball, obviously it's the highest level of competition. But with wrestling, it has that attachment, you know, that stigma that it's a joke. So for you to try, you did do real professional wrestling, that short-lived promotion, which was interesting, but just didn't catch on. You won a title, right? The 184-pound title?
Yeah, real pro wrestling, yes. Yeah, I beat Elite Full Heart, beat 2 Olympians, a national champion, and it was tough. But I also did professional wrestling with TNA. And here's the thing: people don't realize. People might call it a joke, but that is professional wrestling is so hard. Like amateur wrestling is the hardest thing I've ever done. Professional wrestling is the second hardest because you know you have to put your trust in another man to protect you. And if the person's tired, you can't trust them. You're like a stunt man,
right?
You know, you're hitting the ropes, you're jumping over the ropes, jumping through the ropes, getting body slammed, getting thrown to a table, hit with a chair in the back. You're out there to entertain. I've seen guys tear their ACLs early in the match, have to finish the match with a torn ACL. Where in MMA, you tear your ACL, wrestling, call timeout, or you just tap out. You know, but professional wrestling, you have to entertain by all means.
And that's a really interesting point, the idea that people don't think of professional wrestling as a team sport. But the two wrestlers that are in a ring and you know, going at it, you have to trust each other because it may not be quote-unquote fake, but it is choreographed in the way that if you're going to do a move, you both need to know what you're doing.
And here's the thing that's crazy. Sorry about that again. The matches aren't rehearsed. All they do is they talk about them in the back, and then they just freestyle them. So I'll tie up with you, and I'll be like, all right, shoot me off the ropes, and you shoot me off the ropes. You talk while in the ring, and you have to trust your opponent because you see guys like Stone Cold Steve Austin and other people get injured, you know, when they let a guy do a pile driver on them. You know, you see AJ Styles do the Styles Clash, and he broke a guy's neck in Japan. So you have to trust. You have to know what you're getting yourself into, know how to take the bump, and trust in your partner that he won't hurt you.
Let's talk about that, about preparing yourself. Because a lot of that, you know, it's interesting with the freestyle. I mean, let's move off of pro wrestling. Let's get back into what you do, which is MMA.
Yeah.
you know, preparing yourself to be a wrestler, to move into a into an arena in which it is much more hand-to-hand. It is, you know, I mean, they're going for the death blow. What do you have to do to prepare yourself as an athlete to get ready for an experience that is much more cage match than sort of organizing the U.S. national team as a wrestler?
Well, the main thing with the MMA, especially starting and preparing, is you have to get with a good team. You have to get with people that know what they're doing. Because when I first got into it, I got with a guy. He had great intentions, but he didn't really know what he was doing. And I trusted in him. And, you know, I fought injured a lot. We trained stupid. And I realized I made a mistake when I saw other teams. You know, I was watching other people. After a fight, I'd go travel somewhere and train somebody. And, you know, and I'm like, man, these guys are doing something different. We should try that. And then I went to another team. And I was like, they're doing something different. I'm like, maybe I'm doing things wrong. And the thing about, if you want your career to last, you have to have a good team, good training partners, have a good system, and you have to keep your mind open because things are always changing in the sport. You know, you don't want to get stuck in one mode and then the sport evolves before you and you're taking losses.
Well, I would assume that your history with the wrestling teams, the U.S. national team, your discipline in college and in high school comes in handy in that regard. You understand that there is preparation, that there is training. There's a right way to do things. There's a discipline involved in training for something like mixed martial arts.
Oh yeah, you know what? It helped me, but at the same time, like, I just knew the wrestling aspect. I watched boxing. I loved boxing, but I didn't understand the kickboxing aspect. I didn't understand the sparring aspect. I knew, like, you know, in wrestling, we wrestle live, but we're not punching each other. You know, I didn't know much about headgear. You know, I didn't know about any of that. I found out the hard way as I started training, and I started realizing I was making mistakes when I'd go watch people that have been doing it for years train. And that's when I realized, like, okay, I like what I'm doing, but I got to make changes, and maybe I should get with this team. And when you get with a good team, you know, you can take your game to a whole new level.
Wrestling is considered one of the best bases for mixed martial arts because of the competitive aspects and because of there's so much grappling involved, stand up and ground. But the element that is missing is the striking. They don't hit each other. So that is something that, you know, you have to cross train.
Did you have to learn that? I mean, did you have that instinct in you to strike? I mean, do you understand? Or did you, it was just like, okay, I'm just going to learn how to punch.
Well, no, the thing is, like, I remember I was a big boxing fan, so I'd go by the boxing gym a little bit when I was younger, and I learned a jab, and I learned a cross, and I learned a hook. But I never really stuck with it. I just show up and just play around, and, you know, and I got in a few fights here and there. So I kind of knew what it was like to get hit. There are wrestlers out there that are great wrestlers, but the moment you ball your fist up and just throw a punch at them, they turn into cowards, and they turn their head, and they can't react. So you have to actually, like, get used to it. So you have to train that way. You have to, you know, put some headgear on, spar, do drills, get your eyes open, get your awareness right. Because if you're not used to that, then, you know, you're going to be lost.
Muhammad Lawal is known as King Mo. He's the wrestling, or he's part of the big show that is going to be the Bellator 175. The match, the rematch that everybody's looking forward to with Rampage Jackson coming up at the Allstate Arena on Friday night. Let's do this. Let's take a break. We'll get tonight's news. We'll come back and we'll talk about that match, what to expect. I mean, you're actually fighting outside of your class. Moving up to heavyweight just to get this opportunity at a rematch. We'll talk about, you know, what it takes to fight at the level that you fight at. King Mo in studio, James Hirth as well. We'll take a break. Stay with us. Thanks, Rob. This Friday night, Allstate Arena, turning into a cage match. The Bellator 175 comes to town. Bellator, one of the premier MMA leagues in the world. The heavyweight main event, the highly anticipated rematch between Rampage Jackson and my guest tonight, King Mo in studio, James Hirth as well here. We're talking about mixed martial arts on the download tonight. It's fascinating to me because, you know, this is watching all the press conferences and all the media that's put together for this fight. I mean, there's a desire on your part to get back in the cage with Rampage Jackson. What is it about this fight that attracts you? I mean, is it just a payout?
Well, it's not just the payout, but I feel like there are quite a few fights. There's probably about three fights that I lost that I really feel like I won, and even the media agrees with me. And with Quentin, it's one of them. You know, he asked for a rematch before the results are read. He looked shocked when he won. And he think I think he thinks he's better than me, and I'm there to prove that I'm better than him. And the gap has actually widened since we first met. So I want to prove a point and make a statement when I beat him.
Now, a lot of MMA fighting, especially in Bellator, is weight class. You're not in the same weight class anymore, or ever were. I mean, he's a bigger guy. You've waived that and said, I'm okay with fighting at heavyweight. What's the advantage and disadvantage of fighting in a different weight class?
The advantage is, you know, you might be have more speed, you know, more agility, better cardio. But the disadvantage is the size if you're giving it up. And it depends on your style more than anything, because since I can wrestle, I can control where the fight goes. And with the technique, I can actually, if he tries to wrestle me, I can actually tire him out by just wrestling back and playing defense and picking my shots. So it just depends on your style, you know. And because if I was a bully style fighter and I was trying to fight him, it would backfire because he's a bully as well and he's bigger. So you have to be smarter when it comes down to it.
Well, your first fight with Rampage did take place at 205.
Yeah.
So he had to make that weight. Now he's jumped up. His last few fights, he's gotten bigger and bigger, and you've taken advantage of that on social media.
Yeah, a lot of jokes in his direction, right?
Do you see? He said he's bigger and stronger. Do you really see any advantage for him coming in? I mean, what is he going to come in? 260, somewhere around there.
He says 260. We'll see. He could be stronger just off of just carrying the weight. It happens. It's a correlation, but doesn't mean that it's like applicable to fighting. You know, so there are people that can, you know, you could bench press. Say I bench press like 200 pounds, but I put in an extra 50 pounds and I'm still doing the same routine. Just that weight alone could possibly help me, but it's not really applicable to fighting or combat sports in general. So that extra weight could hurt his cardio. It would definitely hurt his agility. It could hurt his range of motion, his flexibility, his timing, you know, everything. Even it could affect his power, because instead of having the power, it'll just make him heavy-handed. Because with power, power is pretty much strength plus speed. If you lose the speed, then you just have strength and you're just using your weight pretty much. And it's just It's like George Foreman. George Foreman wasn't an explosive puncher. He was heavy-handed because he had a dense body. So when he touched you, he crumble you. And that's what Quentin really has, so he carries.
You know, they always talk about professional sports, you know, they talk about, you know, a high percentage of it is mental. And when you're talking about combat sports like this, mixed martial arts, where, I mean, it's lethal when it's so physical, how much of it is mental? How much of it is the preparation, the psychological approach to a fight to get inside a cage?
I think that it's about probably 85 to 90% mental. The rest of it's just preparation and staying injury free, because most fighters that step in the cage, they have some type of injury. You know, they're hiding something. Like we all say, we're 100%, but if we're lucky to be like 85% going into the cage. You know, I've never been 100%. Period. I've usually been about 85 to 90%. At one point, I was fighting at 70%, but it's just a mentality. So you have to get your mind right. You might know, like, okay, here's the thing. Your body is sore. You have an injury, but we can work around that by fighting smart and keeping the fight in your strength. So that's the mental part of it.
But as, you know, the person you're fighting, and you said it yourself right there, I mean, do you look for how they're fighting to see where they might be injured? I mean, do you sort of seek out the fact that someone you're sparring with might have some sort of, might not be at 100%?
Well, it's different with sparring, because when you're sparring, you're still at work.
Or just getting in the cage.
Now, when you're getting in the cage, I don't think about injuries, because, like, if you focus on one injury, if you focus on one thing, then you're narrowing what you could be doing.
Yeah, right.
So, really, I don't really care about the injuries. I just go out there and try to do what I can do. Like, I fought Chet Congo, and I guess he was injured, didn't know. And he was a big guy, but...
Gigantic.
Yeah, he's huge. But the thing is, the way my style worked... His injury really affected him, because my takedowns, I was taking him down, slamming him, I was hitting him the foot sweep, I was turning him, so he really couldn't move like he normally does. And I feel like even if he was healthy, I would have beat him, because just had a perfect game plan for him.
In studio with us, King Mo, we're talking about his big fight, the MMA, the Bellator 175, the rematch with Rampage Jackson, which is on Friday at the Allstate Arena. We'll be on Spike as well. You know, I'm interested in injuries, because you know, as a fighter, is this is what you do for a living? I mean, these are this is serious stuff. I mean, you can get into a cage and have a drag out fight in which, you know, things are sprained, things are broken. I mean, you're, I mean, talk about your history with injuries. I mean, you just talked about, you know, you don't always at all ever fight at 100%. What are some of the injuries that you've gone through?
No current injuries, of course. The week of the fight, let's not talk about that.
No, not the court just passed, but I could say I probably spent, I could say I probably fought about 6-7 fights with no ACL.
You know, just gone.
Gone. Like, I know I tore my ACL in Japan, came back too soon, tore it again versus Mark Kerr, but just kept on fighting. And then after I lost to Fei Zhao, I got surgery, ACL tore again, kept on fighting, put another one in, and then I got a staph infection. So that year I had staph infection. They put the ACL in, it got infected, they took it out. And then I started healing up, and they put another one back in. So I had 1 year, I had 3 ACL procedures in 1 year.
Now, I read, I think it was on your Wikipedia page, just about that staph infection, and that you saw that as sort of a life and death situation.
Yeah.
Talk about that. I mean, you go into a cage and fight for a living. And, you know, your life was almost taken from an infection. I mean, there's something strange about that concept when you think about what you do for a living.
Yeah, like a little bacteria, something you can't see, almost killed me. You know, the infection, it was bad because, like, you know, when I went in, I went had the surgery, they stitched me up. I went to sleep like a night or two later. But when I woke up at night, and I was like, man, it's hot. I'm like, is the heater on? It wasn't. I was sweating. I was like, whatever, I'm going to shake it off. Went to rehab the next morning to rehab my knee. My rehab guy was like, Mo, man, you have 2 golf ball size lumps in your knee, and your knee's kind of warm. He's like, let me put the sticker on it. He had a thermometer sticker. Put it on there. He's like, okay, it's 105 degrees. We need to go to the doctor and get it drained. And I was like, nah, I'm good. It's just healing. It's just blood in there. He's like, nah, just go. So I went. Doctor saw it. He was like, man, this ain't normal. Let me drain it. He put a needle in it. I saw Ghostbuster ectoplasma come from my knee. And he's like, okay, Mo, this ain't normal. Let me run this to the lab. And he ran to the lab. The same day, that night, I'll never forget, it was the night that Chael Sonnen was fighting Rashad Evans. Okay. Right before the main event. Because they're both my boys. So I'm like watching. My doctor calls me. He's like, hey, Mo, come to the ER right now. He found staph in your knee, and we have to do a debridement, flush it out, and then we'll go from there. I go there, they admit me, they have the surgery, wake up, pick line in my arm, and the doctor's like, hey, we'll keep you here for another week and a half. We're going to perform, it was bad, worse than that, we're going to perform a surgery every 48 hours till we can flush it out. And
jeez.
Yeah, once they found out I had an infectious disease doctor, he was like, look, they can't keep on going to your knees, so what we're going to do is we're going to give you like antibiotic IVs to take. I went through 5 of them, and finally they gave me vancomycin, and the vanco is like the chemo of like antibiotics. So they gave me vancomycin. I was on that for like a month and a half, and then, you know, finally they're like, well, it's not good. It's not getting any better. We're going to take the graft out. And once they took it out and they kept on giving me the vancomycin, I got better.
I mean, situations like that obviously come from years of fighting. I mean, that's what that is. And do you think about that when you're in the hospital, when you're in the hospital bed, that maybe it's time to, you know, you're getting older and you're like, maybe if I survive this, if I live, maybe, you know, the cage is not for me.
No, I was thinking like, you know what? This is because here's the honest, you know, crazy. I had staph infection about 4 times before that. And each time it got worse. I had it in my elbow one time. It was bad. They cut my elbow in. Open, flush it out, and they put gauze in it, and I had to switch it out. That was the last time I had it. Then I had it in the knee, and then they're like, "Man, look, we give you vancomycin. We're gonna take the graft out, then put the new one back in. Just do your rehab, and we'll see what happens. But as far as fighting, just put that on the back burner." And I was like,
really?
"Put that on the back burner." I was like, "I'm gonna come back and fight." And I was like, "I can't just. I'm gonna be broke." I was like, "What else am I gonna do?" I was like, "I can't. This is my plan A. I didn't have a plan B." I was like, I got these tattoos on my hands and my neck for a reason. So I was like, you know what? I just stuck with rehab. I did rehab 24/7. I'd wake up and do like stuff for my knee. I put the stem machine on my knee, and I was icing it, and I was doing everything I could. You know, I was massaging the stitches and everything and the staples. And one day, like, you know, I couldn't walk for a while. I was using crutches, and finally,
At the time, I mean, you're saying I'm doing all of this so I can fight again.
Yeah, and finally, it took me like I couldn't walk for literally about 3 months. I was limping, or I was on crutches, and it took me 4 months to where I could walk again. And I was walking, but I had a limp, but I could walk, you know, on my own without crutches. But it was slow, but it took time. And then finally, I started putting weight back on. At that time, when I was sick, I had 102-103 degree temperature for like months, and I was down to 184-185 pounds with my clothes on. So I was like waste away.
But this is, I guess, for us who aren't necessarily, you know, the pay attention to the world of fighters.
Yeah.
These are things that you have to deal with because this is injury. This is the kind of recovery. You know, when you're talking about rehab, you're talking about limping back to get in the ring. You're talking about 24/7 rehab. And let's talk about your life. I mean, you have been a fighter since you were in high school, even before that. I mean, you did wrestling.
Yeah, 16.
But you're, 16. What are you, 35, 36 years old?
I'm 36. I've been competing 36? For 20 years, man.
You've been competing for 20 years. Yeah. You're 36 years old. At a certain point, does your body give out on you to the point where you can't fight with the 22-year-old kids that are coming up? And do you have to think about what's next?
Well, I've been thinking about what's next, but not much, just casually. My thing is, I'm going to stop doing it when it's boring. You know, that's what I did with wrestling. With wrestling, I was like, okay, I wanted to wrestle. I loved it. But then one day I went to practice, and I was like, man, this is boring. I'm not having fun beating up on these guys. I'm not having fun, like, wrestling these guys. I'm like, this is boring. And then when the moment I felt like I didn't want to practice, when I was like, you know what, it's time for me to change things up. And that's what I did. With MMA, now, I love training. I love fighting. I don't like the culture, you know, as much because it's kind of like an internet sport, and everybody wants to be a fighter. You know, it's like a bunch of posers, but the moment I quit and I want to train is when I'm gonna stop. You know, that's what I told myself. I was like, when I don't want to train no more, that's when I'm gonna stop.
Let's talk. I mean, we don't have a lot of time left, but I'm interested in that, the idea of the culture. You know, for you, and I think about this because a lot of people who might listen to my show, not often do we have MMA fighters in here and be able to talk, and there might be the stereotypes of what a fighter is. I mean, it's sort of an uneducated guy who just comes in there who just wants to bash on other people until they see blood, that kind of thing. I mean, there's a lot of misconceptions about fighters, and that's where that culture comes from, where people on the internet are like, I can punch, I'll do this. There's a lot that goes into this. I mean, you were in college, you know, you're educated, you have, you were on the U.S. national wrestling team. There's a lot that goes into preparing yourself, not just physically, but mentally, to have a career in MMA.
There's a lot, and I think people underestimate that. They think, you know, it's a fight. I'm going to go out there and just swing for the fences. I meet people, you know, I remember in Texas when I first started fighting, I went back home, and I meet people from, you know, like at the club, they're like, Mo, man, I might fight like you. I was like, why? I was like, because, man, look, I got into a fight 3 days ago. I got hit with a bottle, and dude tried to stab me. You know, dude hit me with a pistol, and it didn't even hurt me, man. I didn't even go out. And I was like, well, do that when you're tired, because, look, I can punch any of y'all in here, and y'all might not be knocked out. But the moment fatigue kicks in, and you can't think, and you can't stay true to your technique, that's when knockouts happen. And the people don't realize that. It's like it's not about being a better athlete. That helps, but it's about being smarter and being true to your technique. If you can stay true to your technique and have that mental, strong mental conditioning, then you can beat anybody. That's why Floyd Mayweather is undefeated. Like, you watch him, you're like, oh, he's just dancing around, but he don't get hit much. He's mentally, he has strong mental stamina. And that's what a lot of people lack, because you don't see many mental lapses in his game. But that's the difference between, like, professional fighters and people that want to be fighters. It's like, it's all mental. And the guys that want to be fighters just see short term, like, hey, I'm going to go out there and fight for 30 seconds. The guys that are fighters realize, hey, a fight can last 1 second to 15 minutes if it's a 3-round fight, or 1 second to 25 minutes if it's a title fight.
Or Hoist Sakuraba.
Oh, 90 yeah, minutes. Yeah, 90 minutes. Yeah, that,
90
that,
minutes.
Now, that was true mental toughness.
90
right
minutes.
There. Yeah.
Wow.
Until Gracie Corner threw in the towel.
Well, Mo, King Mo, it's a pleasure having you here. I know you're in Chicago for the Allstate Arena show or fight on Friday. Bellator 175 comes to town, presented by Spike. You will be fighting the rematch you've been waiting for, Rampage Jackson, King Mo. That's the time. I mean, if you go anywhere, on and any of the Bellator stuff, anywhere. That's what everybody is talking about. A big fight this Friday at the Allstate Arena. I can't thank you enough for coming in, sharing your story, and being my guest tonight at the big table.
Thanks for having me. This is great right here. I liked it. I enjoyed this interview.
Thank you.
James, thank you too, buddy.
Thank you.
So fun, huh? King Mo in studio. I love it. You know, I don't think that those guys get a lot of opportunities to be able to tell their stories. I mean, if you think about wrestling or mixed martial arts media, it's not unlike, you know, it doesn't seem like there's a lot of outside the lines kind of coverage of, you know what I mean? Not unlike baseball or football or basketball, where most of the media surrounds what they're, you know, what they're doing on the court, what they're doing in a ring or in a cage. But having the opportunity to talk to these athletes in a way that, you know, they can explain their lives and what they go through and what they have to do to prepare for something I would never do. I feel like the idea of the lights being on and being in a cage in the middle of screaming fans would be like the stuff of nightmares. Like, you know, I've got no pants on and I'm in this cage. Like, it just seems very strange, doesn't it? Like, it's just that's what you do for a living, to get in front of. That's amazing. And it's pretty funny. Like, I was watching all the media before, you know, they do the press conferences, the weigh-in kind of stuff. And it's funny how all King Mo was doing was making fun of Rampage Jackson's weight. It's like, but it's really interesting. You know who Rampage Jackson is? I didn't know this until I started watching this stuff. He actually is the guy who played B.A. Baracus in the A-Team movie that came out with Bradley Cooper a couple years ago. That's who he's fighting. Like, he's an MMA fighter. He's not an actor. He's a fighter. Isn't that interesting? All right, we're making a transition. Like I said, tremendously eclectic show tonight. I love it. I mean, there's, you know, hopefully maybe we can get King Mo in here. He can interview me about mental agility. Coming up, Donna Seaman's going to be on the show. I love Donna. She's great. And she is a literary critic. She writes for she's the editor of adult books for Booklist, but she also does stuff in the Tribune. You can see her LA Times. And her new book, Identity Unknown, Rediscovering 7 American Women Artists. As we talked about at the top of the show, it is startling, the sort of omission of the contributions and the great art of women in history, art history. I mean, really, on the top of our head, we were doing this exercise earlier in the show about how deep you can go in the artists that are known in, you know, to not just art lovers, but to, you know, people who just in the mainstream. You know, you do Frida Kahlo and maybe a Gertrude Stein, and then that drops off. It's a male-dominated field, and you don't think about that. And Donna has profiled 7 undiscovered, just really sort of, I wouldn't say undiscovered, rediscovering. 7 women artists who made contributions to the art world. And we'll talk with Donna coming up. Also, Monica Eng's coming in. Talk about the Chicago hot dog. She's also bringing her daughter, who I don't know if this is good or bad, in the sense that her daughter Miranda is an 8th grader, and she has caught the audio documentary bug, not unlike that's what Monica does. And so Miranda is putting together podcasts, one on documenting the homeless population on Michigan Avenue, another on documenting her classmates and what they think of finding Trump supporters and other supporters to sort of follow them podcast form throughout their high school careers. And what has Monica done? I should call DCFS. That's just, you know?
You know, I'd like for my kids to catch the anesthesiologist bug.
Right, exactly.
Or the legal bug.
Right, right. All right, so that's coming up. We'll take a quick break and we'll get to the show. Stay with us. Thanks, Rob. It's a download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Coming up a little bit later in the show, Monica Eng will be here. Talk about the Chicago hot dog. She's bringing her daughter, who also is made a move into the podcast world. I don't know what Monica's doing. And she called DCFS. I don't know why you would subject your daughter to the audio world. But they're good. I listen to them. She's good. She's an 8th grader, and she's doing podcasts. And we're going to talk with Miranda coming up in the 9:30 segment. Also coming up at 10 o'clock, we'll play The Worst. Holly Laurent is here at Chicago Improv Festival weekend. Holly Laurent, a longtime main stage actor at the Second City, now in Los Angeles doing L.A. Hollywood things, and she will be in studio. She's got a show at the Improv Festival tomorrow, so she'll play the worst with us tonight. 312-981-7200, where we complain about the worst things in our society for prizes. That's a pretty simple concept. Well, my next guest is a great Chicago editor, literary critic, and writer. Donna Seaman has been the editor for adult books at Booklist for years and also has reviewed books for The Trib and LA Times. She's also written essays and published a collection of her interviews in Writers on the Air, conversations about books. But her latest book has nothing to do with books. Instead, Donna turns her attention to the visual arts. Art history hasn't been kind to women artists. Beyond Frida Kahlo and Georgia O'Keeffe, many women have contributed great art but haven't been recognized like their male peers. And in many cases, women have had several more obstacles to sustain professional careers in their fields. Donna profiled some noteworthy names in history in her new book called Identity Unknown, Rediscovering Seven American Women Artists. She'll be reading and taking questions at the Seminary Co-op Bookstore in Hyde Park tomorrow night at 6 o'clock. And then for those in Milwaukee, she'll be appearing at Boswell Book Company in Milwaukee on Thursday at 7 o'clock. Donna Seaman in studio. Donna, good to see you. Thanks for being here.
Justin, thank you so much. I'm thrilled.
This is a fascinating book, really a topic that I didn't know much about. I don't have much of an art background, but to think about, as Pete and I kind of played the game at the top of the show, beyond Frida Kahlo and Georgia O'Keeffe, there's a cliff. I mean, it really is. History has not been kind in the art world to women artists.
Oh, that's exactly right. And the amazing thing is the seven artists I write about in Identity Unknown all achieved recognition in their lifetime. And that's what was so mystifying to me. They sold work. They had shows. They were interviewed. There's a record of their achievements after they died. The art history people just ignored them. And
how does that happen? I mean, I guess that probably happens in a lot of artistic fields, and we don't think about that. But why is it so obvious in art?
It's so glaring in art, and I think part of it is who's writing the art history. So for a long time, it was men. And it's a very small field compared to other realms, somewhat rarefied. And I think, too, that each of these women artists that I chose to write about were so independent. They didn't follow schools. They changed their styles. They were really rebellious on all fronts. So maybe they were difficult to categorize.
Yeah, maybe. Some of them have Chicago connections. For you, as someone who has spent your life in books, reviewing books, writing essays, interviews, those kinds of things, what's your connection? Why go into profiling visual artists?
Yeah, the visual arts. How dare I, right? Well, secretly, at least secretly in my life in Chicago, I have a very strong visual art background. My mother's an artist. I grew up looking at art and watching a woman artist at work. I myself went to art school. And this always surprises people because I am such a literary person. But art school was a tremendous experience. And having spent time in the studio and built things and painted made me feel that writing about women artists, that I could really speak to all aspects of it because I'd experienced studio life. I'd also done a tremendous amount of reading in the visual arts starting as a student. So that kind of fueled this whole book with my interest in women artists and the paltry coverage of their lives.
Well, I mean, the book, obviously, we'll talk about the artists that are actually examined in Identity Unknown, Rediscovering Seven American Women Artists, Some with Connections to Chicago. The other part of the book, which is really interesting to me, too, is this concept of what it takes to have a professional career in visual arts. I mean, there seems to be much more of a balancing act for women to pursue a full-time career in arts than men.
Absolutely. One of my interests in art and writing about art was that the artists I'm portraying were painters and sculptors, which means you need a studio and you need materials. If you're a writer, you don't need much. You can have a pad of paper and a pen and a computer if you're lucky. To actually build and paint things requires a tremendous commitment. And so it was a financial burden for women to be able to make art. And these are all 20th century artists. They're all deceased.
Right. The last was 2007, though.
Exactly.
So it's not, we're not talking about centuries ago.
No. Right. Of course, Lenore Tawney, who's one of the Chicago connected artists, lived to be 100. So she went through the earlier phases.
Yeah.
So all these women having a career, for one thing, was a radical departure from being a wife and mother. And women are paid less. Women are still paid less. And for them, even the women in my book who were who taught at universities and colleges were paid less than their male peers. So the whole endeavor of making visual art was very tough, just materially speaking, let alone all the issues of how do you spend your time and sort of guilt-tripping women about wanting to do their own work instead of taking care of family.
I mean, it's also – it's fascinating to me, too, because, you know, I think about it now, and I guess that's part of – the point of this book is I think about the modern landscape when it comes to artists, and I don't necessarily feel like women are underrepresented. You know, and I only, it's anecdotal, meaning I will have friends and artists who will put in galleries in Chicago and put things together, and you recognize that it seems to be somewhat equal in the way that, that women are presented in gallery spaces, other places in Chicago. That's what's so surprising about the way that history rewrites this story.
Well, you know, it's interesting, Justin, because there's a group of women artists who keep track statistically of women's exhibits, and they will tell you that, no, it's not equal. That to this today, that if you tally up the number of pieces by women in museums, they're still much less than half.
And there have been big protests about that. I think of the protests in New York City, the Gorilla Girls, and this idea that there has been public demonstration and protest about inequality when it comes to artists in represented in galleries and museums.
Yes, and there's no lack of good work. I mean, there's 7 artists in this book. There could have been 100 easily.
How did you choose? Let's go through Gertrude Abercrombie, Joan Brown, Ree Morton.
Yeah.
Am I saying this? Lois Malou Jones, is that right?
Lois Malou Jones.
Lois Malou Jones. Lenore Tawney, Christina Ramberg, and Louise Nevelson.
Yes.
How do you choose that? Like you said, there's hundreds or so of artists, women artists. How do you choose these 7?
Well, it sort of began with Louise Nevelson for me. Louise Nevelson's the best known artist in the book. Many people will have heard of her. I loved her work growing up. And she was my first source of shock, because when she died in 1988, when I started reviewing art books in the 90s and looking for things, I always looked for Louise Nevelson in books about modern sculpture, and she was not in there. And that started my whole interest in, like, how could that possibly be? You know, male artists of her time were always represented. So I started thinking about this whole question and just sort of looking for other women artists whose work really moved me. I wanted to write about artists whose work had a real impact on me in that way that art affects you,
right?
Sort of beyond even articulation. You just sort of feel it in your body. So the work of Gertrude Abercrombie, who was a Chicago artist, lived in Hyde Park, right near the U of C campus, was a fascinating painter. She these spooky kind of prairie landscapes. She painted, they were all self-portraits, but very symbolic. You know, she had herself, she's in these long penitential gowns, and she looks, sometimes she paints herself as a magician. She was called the Queen of Bohemia. She knew Studs Terkel. She knew a lot of all the jazz musicians that came through Chicago in the 1940s. She also played the piano. Her house was a real hangout for creative people. She was just phenomenally interesting.
You tell the story, and I feel like, man, you're talking about Studs Terkel. You're talking about Nelson Algren. Why is Gertrude not remembered?
What
happened to the sort of even telling her story?
Exactly.
So, Christina Ramberg's another one in Chicago.
Now, Christina Ramberg, she's the only artist in the book I actually knew. And she passed away in the mid-1990s. She was a teacher. She was first a student and then a teacher at the School of the Art Institute. Now, Christina's work is known. She was part of the Chicago Imagists. So she has in Chicago, people know her and remember her, but she really should be much better known. She should be known all across the world and all across the country. It was very meaningful to me to be able to tell Christina's story.
Well, I mean, I guess the question that comes out of it is, you talk about, the personal connection or the regional connection, the local connection.
Right.
You know, and I guess this can apply to different arts when you think about music or you think about, other forms of writing. sometimes, you know, the national scene might be different than the local scene, or the history only remembers the broad strokes of artists that play out on a national level. Is that, I mean, could that be some of the argument for why women artists, especially the seven that you profile in this book, aren't remembered? The fact that maybe they have a little bit more local prominence and they didn't register on a national level?
Well, that's true. In Gertrude's case, for sure. She just could, you know, New York has always been the real art central. Another reason I wanted to write this book was to remind people that art was being made in this whole big country. So Gertrude just never got her footing in New York. Gertrude had a lot of issues in her life, too. She did not have the easiest time. Yeah. But the other artists, for instance, Lois Mailou Jones, who was born in Boston, ended up teaching at Howard University. She was an African-American artist who traveled all over the world. You know, she had a sabbatical in Paris. She turned herself into an art ambassador, traveled throughout Africa, meeting artists in Africa, introducing them to American artists and vice versa. So there's no way she was a local talent. She was international in every sense of the word. A phenomenal person.
History, as they say, you know, is almost remembered by those who write it. Is there, with this book, with a sort of shedding a light on the fact that in the visual arts community there has been this inequality, do you think that as art history moves on and contemporary voices are added to that history, do you think that it'll change, that there will be more women represented in the canon of visual art in this country?
I definitely do. As you were saying earlier, there are so many women artists working now and doing profoundly interesting and original work. There's also a lot more women writing about art. Mm-hmm. And I think writing about art has really evolved. It used to be very academic. And, I mean, you had newspaper critics who were brilliant, and it was interesting, and most of them were men. And then in the 70s, you know, we had some of the great art writers, Barbara Rose and Linda Nochlin and Marcia Tucker. And so the dialogue expanded and the conversation changed. And I think that's really sustained now. I think with online magazines and blogs, there's so much strong, good art writing going on by both men and women. So there's many more opportunities. It's so much easier to see visual art. You know, when you write a book, I mean, everyone can acquire books. You can go to the library, you know, the books are easier. To see visual art can be very tough. You know, museums can be expensive. A lot of people are kind of shy about going to galleries, or too busy, you know, have too much in their lives. Well, now you can go online, and so many museums have posted their collections. So I feel like the democratization of visual art is really increasing, and I think that's so exciting.
Well, it's a fascinating book. The book is called Identity Unknown, Rediscovering Seven American Women Artists. The author, Donna Seaman, longtime editor of adult books at Booklist, also does reviews for the Chicago Tribune, for the LA Times. She's going to be reading from the book, talking about the book, signing the book, Identity Unknown, at Seminary Co-op in Hyde Park tomorrow at 6 o'clock, and then in Milwaukee on Thursday at Boswell Book Company. Donna, pleasure to see you. I hope that we can get you back in here. We can talk about, maybe we'll talk about books.
Oh, I'd love that, Justin. Anytime. I love radio.
Thanks for coming in. Thanks, Rob. To download here on 720 WGN, I'm Justin Kaufman. My guest in studio knows a thing or two about the Chicago hot dog, or learned a little bit about it. Monica, how much did you know about the Chicago hot dog before you did this story?
Well, I'm a lifelong Chicagoan, so I knew, you know, what goes on to it, but I had no idea about sort of the intricate backstory of every ingredient.
I not to sort of, you know, when Monica, of course, works for the public media, the radio station in town, and she also works for the Chicago Tribune. She has a podcast, Chewing. You know, I'm fascinated. And like I said, I want to show too much how the sausage is made. But you sent me 2 pages.
Yes. I wanted to
like
make sure
you wrote
prepared.
It out. Like you're like, this is what a Chicago hot dog is. This is what you need to know. And I was like, who are you talking to? You don't think I know it? I mean, Drag Through the Garden. I know everything about the Chicago hot dog. I've won a couple James Beards here. I know. I understand.
Yeah, you always remind me of that.
Yeah, right. Yeah. So talk about what this was a Curious City question, and this was about where did the Chicago hot dog and the ingredients that are involved in the Chicago hot dog come from?
Yeah, and so we had several people asking it, and I said, you know what? It's about time we answer this question. I went to the preeminent hot dog historian in the United States, Bruce Craig. He's an emeritus professor at Roosevelt University. He's written Hot Dog, A Global History. He's written Man Bites Dog. Mm-hmm. And we sat down, and we dissected this. So you're not going to tell them, so I'll tell them. Here are the seven, and don't feel dumb if you don't know it, because Justin thinks...
I know it. Thinks, I didn't even read your document.
All right, quiz. Okay. What are the seven ingredients?
So do you include the bun and the wiener?
No, because seven things on top of that.
On top of that,
so
okay.
What kind of wiener?
Let's
what
go
kind
sell,
of bun?
Okay, so the wiener is the Vienna beef. Well, I don't know what you call it, but the...
Hot dog, Frankfurter, whatever.
Yeah. Okay, and the bun is a poppy seed. We got that.
That's steamed easy. Poppy seed.
All right. Yeah, here we go. Okay, I feel like this is a celery salt's got to be in there.
That's
chopped
right.
Onion's got to be in there. The green relish has got to be in there. The spear, the pickle, the big tomato, mustard, and the jalapeno peppers.
Spore peppers.
Sorry, I screwed that up. If this was, they would give me a zero on Family Feud if on the lightning round.
That was very good. And what is never on there, according to Chicago?
Ketchup, right? Yeah.
Okay.
People don't know that. This is, I guess, the point, Monica. You've been covering food in Chicago for a long time.
Yeah.
I feel like the Chicago hot dog or the ingredients that go into it is something that, you know, you have to put your hand on the Bible and then recite the seven ingredients
that are
on top of a Chicago hot dog, dragged through the garden.
Yeah, otherwise you're not a Chicago.
But you found out that a lot of people are not familiar with this.
No, a lot of people that I work with who've been in Chicago for a long time did not know that these seven ingredients are sort of mandatory. And not only did they not know that, but they didn't know the history behind them. And it's a really fascinating history. About 100 years ago on Maxwell Street, you had a lot of, well, first we had German immigrants come here, and then they dominated the sausage trade, but then a lot of Eastern European Jewish immigrants came here. And they said, you know, how about if we make this not a pork and beef wiener, but an all beef? And the United States, Chicago happened to be the beef capital of the country.
Right,
80% of all beef in the nation was processed right here in 1910. So we had a ton of beef. We had a ton of sausage makers, all beef wiener. But how did the...
Yeah, how'd you get all seven of these ingredients?
Okay, mustard. That comes from both the English and especially the German immigrants here. Onions, that's pan-European. So you could go Greek, you could go Mexican, you can go
A lot of influences,
German.
Right?
The relish was a cousin of piccalilli, which is a sort of actually an Indian pickle from India that came to England, that came to the United States through British immigrants, and then we made it sweet because it would have been a little sort of salty, but here we decided to got to put some sugar in it. And in Chicago, it's got to be neon green.
Right. Where does the neon green come from? Is that just
that
a Chicago thing?
That comes from blue dye number four that Vienna puts in.
Okay, all right.
And then you've got the celery salt. Mm-hmm. That is the one mystery. Nobody's quite sure why that came on. The German sausage makers like to use it as a seasoning. And the nitrate in there is something you would normally find in sausage. So there is natural nitrate in there. But do you know what the celery capital of the United States was around the time that this hot dog was happening?
Chi-town?
Lakeview. Lakeview was a huge celery farm.
So maybe there's something there. Maybe
Wrigley Field, something like that. You know, Lakeview.
It was interesting because we had King Mo, the MMA fighter, was in here at 8 o'clock and he had his crew in. And one of the publicists was talking about, I said, later we're talking about the Chicago hot dog. And she was from New York. And she was like, she was caught up in thinking the Chicago hot dog had to do specifically with the hot dog. I mean, the actual meat.
Exactly. That's what someone said. That's the thing. The hot dog is a
Yeah, but people don't recognize because when I went through, these are it's really about the toppings. Mm-hmm. It's about sort of how much vegetation is on the hot dog when it's done is what makes it a Chicago hot dog. So it's interesting that she also had the misconception.
Yeah, so we can't all assume that everybody knows, okay, we haven't gotten to the sport peppers. Sport peppers came during the Columbian Exposition when a whole bunch of Mexican tamale vendors came to Chicago. People got this taste for spicy Mexican peppers, and then what do you know?
Right.
We suddenly have all these pickled sports peppers, which actually come from McElhaney Island, or Avery Island, the McElhaney Company, same as Tabasco.
It's amazing to me, if you think about how the hot dog is concocted and everything that goes into it, that it really does reflect the Chicago sort of melting pot idea that there's so many different people and ethnicities here that make this city. The hot dog, surprisingly, when you think about it, it reflects that.
It totally does. And these were a lot of the folks who were hanging around Maxwell Street around the turn of the century. And finally, Tomato was the Greek and Italian greengrocers who were also right there in that Maxwell Street area. And they thought, you know what? Let's have some added value. We've got these fresh tomatoes. Let's put it on there. Finally, the pickle, Eastern European.
Yeah, I was going to say, that might be a lot of where the tradition comes from, Maxwell Street, because there were so many vegetable vendors down there and the idea of so many different ethnicities represented at that time. Monica Ang, you can find the story. I think it's online at WBEZ.org, yep. Curious City. And also, you know, you continue, I would assume just from your Facebook and social media, that you're continuing to look for the Chicago hot dog. You can't really have a hot dog stand in Chicago that doesn't have that front and center.
I think so. I mean, it's what defines
us. Do you see a differential? I mean, are there, over time, have you seen any sort of differential in the way that it's presented? I mean, I saw a nice post where you were talking about one shop over another shop and the way that people sort of put the hot dog together.
Well, the biggest difference you'll find is at Superdog on Milwaukee Avenue. They'll put pickled green tomatoes on there. And I don't know anybody else who does that. So instead of the red tomatoes in the winter, they'll put pickled green ones. But otherwise, I haven't seen many variations. Some people do skip the celery salt, too.
Are you a hot dog eater? I mean, is this something that you, before this time, did you take on this assignment because you're like, I know the hot dog?
Well, come on. I grew up in Chicago. We used to eat at Irving's a lot and Byron's. And the Gold Coast Dogs over here used to do a really nice one. But, you know, I'm kind of partial, and I know I shouldn't be eating meat a lot, but to the Maxwell Street Polishes and Maxwell Street pork chop sandwiches.
Right,
and do you know what the traditional toppings for those are?
For Polish would just be onions.
Is there
a condiment?
It's grilled onions, mustard, and sport peppers. So you go down to Jim's Original and you say, hey, I want one with everything on it. 90 seconds later, I have timed this, you will have a nice hot bag with these wonderful caramelized onions, mustard, sport peppers, and then free fries are always in there.
And then the same with the pork chop sandwich. Same thing?
But watch out with the pork chop sandwich because it's bone-in. Chicago is well known for its bone-in pork chop sandwiches. You could lose a tooth if you're not careful.
It is true. It's funny because I think about, all the Chicago hot dog place that used to be the go-to lunch. I mean, in a way that you would get the deal and it'd be like $3-4 and be able to get stuff. I just feel like it's bringing me back, and I feel like that's been missing in my life. I might have to bring back the Chicago hot dog.
And it's delicious.
Diet.
When I talked to Bruce Craig, I said, well, why don't we put ketchup on there? He says, when you think about it, this is a symphony of flavors and textures that is balanced of spicy, salty, sweet, hot, cold, warm. And if you put ketchup on it, it would obliterate that whole balance.
Monica Ang is one half of the podcast Chewing, which you can find at, it's a Tribune? Is it
Chewing.xyz.
There you go, Chewing.xyz. And she did this story for Curious City at WBEZ. All right, let's take a quick break. We come back. Let's talk to Miranda, who is in studio, about her podcast. The eighth grader here in Chicago has picked up the audio bug. I don't know where from. And I'm not sure I like this. I don't like it, but two projects that you're working on. We'll talk about both of them coming up here on The Download. Stay with us. Welcome back to Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, we talked to Monica Ang about her story about the Chicago hot dog. And let's move on and talk with, and this blows my mind that you did this, Monica, but you got your daughter, Miranda, into the world of audio production. Miranda Zonka is an eighth grader, daughter of Monica, and you have developed two audio projects, one on homeless life on Michigan Avenue and the other about sort of following the politics of your fellow eighth graders. Let's talk about this. Miranda, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks
Good
for
to see
me.
You. All right, so let's talk about this. I mean, obviously, we'll deal with why your mom got you into audio production at a different point.
Because of you.
Right,
you
literally
got me into it.
No, so let's talk about the projects. Let's start with the homeless podcast or project. I mean, this is really about How did you stumble upon it? What was your goal of trying to put this project together?
You know, I think it's sort of like the last interview. You know, I lived in Chicago my whole life, and you, especially being downtown a lot, you pass a lot of homeless people, and you hear different things from the people that you're with, like, don't have pity, they got themselves into this situation, give them money, don't give them money. So I sort of just wanted to find out for myself, like, well, you know, what got them here? And of course, everybody's story was different, but it was just really interesting for me to see that. And then I think it's also important for people who live in this city to, you know, sort of acknowledge this thing that
right.
they really just try to ignore. So
how do you approach it? I mean, obviously, you know, the yeah. homeless are a part of Michigan Avenue here. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of traffic that goes by, and a lot of times the signs are in front. How did you approach the people that were on the street, and what did you suggest when yeah. you threw a mic in their face?
I think it was sort of like, you have to be direct. And I was actually really pleasantly surprised at how open these people were and how really, like, they trusted me. They just told me everything. But yeah, it was just sort of like going up to them, asking them, hey, can I interview you? You know, I'll pay you $5 for, you know, 5 minutes of interview. And they're like, yeah, okay.
Well, one of them said, make it eight.
Yeah, one of them was like,
they were negotiating.
Yeah.
Okay.
So,
well, that'll be the first lesson. At some point yeah, or another, you yeah. probably not want to pay
yeah.
the
yeah,
sources.
And normal journalism, normal, yeah,
yeah,
yeah, yeah,
yeah, yeah, right. But let's listen to some of this. Let's start with the clip with AJ. Why don't
sure.
we do that, Pete? About you got food. The AJ about this is about food on Michigan yeah. Avenue. Let's try that.
You know what? Honestly, we get so much food out here. I mean, I get more than anybody could ever eat. I mean, so a lot of times I end up actually throwing away a lot of food. But people get mad. I mean, like, if I'm sitting here and I got, like, 8 bags of food around me, and they come up and they try to give me a fourth pizza for today, you know, and I tell them, you know, hey, I got plenty of food. Maybe somebody else don't have anything. They actually get mad. I've had people throw it at me out here. Like New Year's Eve, some guy walked by, had a bunch of food around me, tried to give me his food, and he's like, you're the third fucking bum that I've tried to give food today and wouldn't take it. It's like, whoa, dude, look around me. I mean, if I have plenty, why am I going to continue to take something that I'm just going to throw away? So,
a lot of people did give me food and pizza. I ate so much pizza. I'm still eating a lot of pizza. I'm like, okay. But it has helped me to get through that day. You know, I'll eat it sitting out here. And then I have two family members that we kind of work together, and it helped us to eat that day because money is scarce. You know, it's scarce right now.
So how did you decide, and Miranda, the questions that you wanted to ask? I mean, because this was obviously about food, which is, I mean, it's curious. I mean, it's, mm-hmm. it's sort of to better understand the life of somebody on Michigan Avenue.
Well, I think a lot of it was sort of like just my thinking in general about, like, you know, I was curious. And so I thought of a few questions out of like a ton of questions that I just had in my brain that I thought were sort of important to ask. And this one specifically was more just like, you know, there's a lot of stuff that, like, you know, you can get very caught up thinking about what you can do for people and like how this is such an overwhelmingly huge cause around you. And you're just like, well, I can't help this person as an individual. But I think one thing that you hear a lot is, well, you can give them your leftovers and that helps them a lot. And so, you know, just thinking about that as somebody who does that a lot, you know, just thinking
you wanted
I can
to ask,
help.
Well,
yeah.
do they even want the leftovers?
Yeah. And,
right.
and how do you
think
find about
it? You
like,
ask.
Okay.
Well, I mean, there's a
yeah.
delicate balance, and I think you mm-hmm. hear that a little bit in the tape, just this concept of people want to help. They're not
yeah.
giving food as sort of like a trash receptacle. They're saying, I want to help. I want to do what I can, right?
Yeah.
And it is great to interview the people on Michigan Avenue to understand what they want and why they want it.
Yeah.
I mean, did you get into why they were there? What brought them, the scenarios that brought these people
mm-hmm.
to be on the streets in Michigan Avenue, Chicago?
One of the questions I did ask, yeah, was like, you know, what are some of the factors that led you into homelessness? Two of them, I think, it might have been the most actually, were incarceration and just sort of like bad thing after another. One of them was job loss. Another was somebody's house burnt down. It was a lot of just like bad luck.
The other thing you asked was really about weather. And
yeah.
that's something that obviously we think about a lot. Let's hear a clip mm-hmm. From Philip on the issue of weather.
When it's cold out, how do you stay warm? How do you?
I ride the train.
Yeah.
Ride the train. I have to ride the train because something was one time I went to the shelter and had to sleep on the stairwell with a blanket because they didn't have enough room. You know, they didn't have enough room. So the best thing for me to do is get a little rest on the train and start my day asking if I can get if somebody can help me. It takes a minute. You have to have patience.
Miranda, where can we find these stories? Where do you have them? You have them up on your website, right?
Yes. So they're on a website. It's called Life on Michigan Avenue. You can look it up. It's a Wix site. Made it with Wix. great site to make websites. But, yeah, you can find it online. Also on SoundCloud, actually, if you just wanted to listen to the audio. But it's a pretty cool website. I like it.
All right. So let's move on to your other project because one's just not enough.
Yeah. Couldn't help myself.
Let's talk about the podcast. This is called Trump and the Eighth Grade. Mm-hmm. This is you were in eighth grade.
Yes.
And talk about this. This is a political podcast. You're asking your classmates about who they support, why they support them, and your promise to follow through.
Uh-huh. Well, okay. So like a lot of people, the reason why I did this, like a lot of people, when Trump was elected, I was shocked, I was upset, and I ended up getting into a lot of arguments with people, whether it was online, in person, whatever. And I sort of realized, like, I'm totally not understanding or taking in any part of what this person is telling me. I'm just telling them that they're wrong and that I'm right. And then another thing that sparked it was Obama's farewell speech. He was saying, if you don't like, you know, arguing with people over the internet, go and talk to them in person. And I thought that was really important and really, you know, he was right that we should totally be doing that. So I decided to go do it, to go talk to people, just make them feel safe and have them tell me, you know, what they thought.
And what did you find? I mean, when you're talking to students, eighth grade, especially in Chicago, you probably have a lot of like-minded students. Mm-hmm. But there's some that you can find that actually represent a Trump voter. Obviously, they're not voters yet, but have those mm-hmm. sensibilities.
Well, yeah, it was definitely slim pickings for Trump supporters. But I did find one. And I know that he's actually sort of been in and out of supporting Trump. And I found it really interesting because I know that he has sort of opened his mind. He's actually the most open-minded person I interviewed because I know that people have told him that he's wrong, that they don't like the way he thinks and that, you know, he's wrong. And he's definitely taken into account some of the stuff that people have said to him. He does not agree with Trump on how he treats women. He does not agree with Trump on how he's treating gay people, gay marriage, and transgender people. So I know that he's actually, surprisingly, you know, not the way I would have thought of it, but he is the most open-minded person I interviewed.
And the other two were Democrat supporters and Green Party supporters.
And so, the Green Party I just thought was pretty interesting. Yeah, because Democrats, a lot of Democrats and people who are, you know, within the liberal sort of standpoint against Trump, essentially, in my school. And I thought that Sadie was the interview who was a Democrat. She was important to represent just to show sort of, it was almost like the control, honestly. And I wanted to be able to compare and contrast with these two other points of view. And I think that Liam, who is for the Green Party, was interesting just because a lot of people actually in the election blamed third party voters and people who didn't vote, actually.
It was,
yeah, he really talked about, and he did support Bernie up until the point that he had to drop out. But I think it was interesting to hear, like, you know, I didn't want to throw my beliefs away. I believed in this, and I thought that she was going to bring, you know, peace and unity to America, so.
There we go. Miranda Zonka, the podcast, where can we find it?
SoundCloud.
There you
find
go.
It on SoundCloud.
I'll tweet out both of these on the @Monica Eng Twitter site. I'll tweet out. Both.
Miranda Zonka, Monica Eng, in studio tonight, talking about the podcast that you're creating at eighth grade. Miranda.
Through senior year through when they're all year. Old enough right. to vote.
Yeah. I can't thank you enough for coming in.
Thank you.
Thanks,
thank
guys. All right, it's time for the worst here on the download. 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Very excited tonight. Old friend back in town. The Chicago Improv Festival is in town, and that means a lot of great improvisers come in from the coast to perform and entertain the masses here in Chicago. The 20th anniversary of the festival. In studio tonight, very excited to have Holly Laurent, a longtime Chicago improviser. She was on the Second City main stage, and she is now living in Los Angeles. She's back for a show tomorrow night at Second City ETC, which will be at 8 o'clock. She is with her longtime stage partner, Katie Rich, and they are performing with the group Virgin Daiquiri on stage at the ECC. Holly, great to see you.
Hey, thanks
Welcome
for having
back.
Me. I'm a true Chicagoan. I'm happy in these streets.
having the streets.
I'm having these streets.
The streets of Michigan Avenue.
That's right. Although they're very gray.
Yeah, that, right.
The ride in from O'Hare today, I was like, I am very familiar with this road, and she's still ugly.
She's still ugly. That is a good way to put it. And the worst is when we have these gray days, especially when we're so close to spring, right?
And I heard it was real warm last week. Did that do a number on you?
It was just a lot of short shorts. There's just a ton of short shorts walking, and you're like, you know what? Just wait a couple months to get those short shorts out. But Chicago does it all the time.
Chicagoans get overzealous.
Yeah, they're like, I got them out too. I mean,
that skin wants to see the light.
312-981-7200. We're playing the worst tonight for prizes. This is where we complain about the worst things in society. For pizza. That's the fun of
that's
it.
That's the best.
I know. I promised you pizza, and I totally forgot. So but you know what? I'll get you back next time.
Okay. Next time, then it's going to have to be a Lou Malnati's deep dish butter crust, well done, uncut, with spinach, mushroom, and garlic, easy on the
I
garlic
could have done
side
that.
Of extra tomato sauce.
I didn't even think. Look at you. I remember you said that, and I'm like, oh, yeah, we get pizza here for Holly. No problem. And then I totally forgot.
Well, I'm not going to forget.
Yeah. I can already see that.
You know,
steely glaze.
Outside of Chicago, when people know you're from Chicago, that's one of the main things. You know, overseas, they always say, oh, Al Capone, do-do-do-do-do.
Yeah.
Or they say Michael Jordan.
Right.
But in the States, what I've realized is it's pizza. And they're always like, I'll even have like Lyft drivers be like, so what's, okay, as a Chicagoan, what's the best Chicago? And I'm like, oh, people are going to tell you different things. I'm the one that's right. And it's Lou Malnati's.
And it's Lou Malnati's. Oh, perfect. Gosh. That's what we have to give away tonight. As a prize for sort of commenting on the worst. This is really the greatest hour in Chicago radio, because all you have to do is complain about your day.
Okay.
And if it's strong enough, you get a pizza.
Yeah.
Right? There's not too many other, I mean, we don't have to play games. There's no trivia.
Yeah.
You don't have to show us your talent.
Right.
You just have to complain about something that happened at 312-981-7200 and you get a pizza.
And if there's something I know about people, is they like to complain.
To complain. Right.
I mean, this is too easy. You're just creating a place for them.
That's right.
Yeah.
All right, let's start tonight. Let's start with Pete Zimmerman, as we do every single episode of The Worst. Pete, how are you, my friend?
I'm wonderful.
All right, why don't you kick us off?
Well, speaking of Lyft,
yeah.
What's the worst?
What's the worst, Pete?
When your Lyft driver or your Uber driver profiles you and changes the radio station. Like, just because I'm an old white guy doesn't mean I want to hear Steely Dan. Leave the jams on, man.
Oh, that's so great. Like, they're playing something good, and you're like, oh, that's good. And they're like, he's not going to like this rap.
Yeah, exactly.
I can tell by the cut of this guy. He's more of a classic rock guy.
Mm-hmm.
That's really efficient
for Rush. A lot of rock here, a lot of Rush.
There you go.
Yeah.
Good start tonight.
Nice.
You know, and usually the great thing about the worst is that it almost like it catches a trend.
Mm-hmm.
So if you start in one direction, like this happens all the time when we say, you know what's the worst about grocery stores? Then you'll get like a ton of grocery stores. So don't be surprised if tonight becomes just a ride share mess.
Okay, cool.
312-981-7200. All right, Holly.
Yeah.
What do you got? What's the worst?
Ooh.
Ooh.
The word post-fact? I mean, is there any, right? The only thing maybe on par with that is when you're really looking forward to the thing you saved in the refrigerator and you're coming home and somebody ate it.
Yeah.
Or drank it. Thing you saved that you know is there and you're thinking about it and you're like saving yourself for it and it's not there.
Right. Of your six roommates, you're painting a picture of you. Like, or is this,
no, this is
particularly,
my husband.
I was going to say, is this one person?
This is my husband. I've divorced him 10 times for this. He's not aware of it. But in my mind, I've been like, that's it.
Is he a loose eater? I mean, he's the kind of guy who's like, whatever's in the fridge, I'll eat it.
Yeah.
I feel like there's rules. You're right. Like, there's no way I'm digging into something unless I know it's okay to do so.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, he's eaten the thing. It was my takeout. It was my leftovers. You know what I mean?
Yeah, that's not good.
That's crossing
that is the
line,
worst.
Right?
That's the worst.
That's the worst. Do you think it's worse than the word post-fact?
I think it might be on par, which is another the worst. People say on par.
On par. Or what about, is it worse than the like slippery slide of leaving an imperfect but beautiful democracy and just sliding into a tyrannical dictatorship?
I mean, I think post-fact's probably worse.
Okay.
That's the worst. That's worse than that.
Okay. Okay,
312-981-7200. 630 says, Uber driver here. iMusic genre profile. But at least I change the channel before the rider gets near the car. See, that's the key.
Oh.
You already get a picture or you get an idea. You see Pete show up and you're like, Pete's probably a classic rock guy. I'm going to get Rush ready.
Uh-huh.
It's the lazy guys who are like, oh, I forgot. I better do it right now.
Yeah.
It's too late, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, right?
I always think they're playing their music. I've always been like, oh, what does this tell me about this person?
Maybe they don't need to profile you. Maybe they're like, you know, Holly's cool. She's going to get what I get. Pete is a little bit different. Like, in the sense that perhaps they're like, this guy's not going to get me, so I need to change it to what I think he likes.
Well, now I'm going to be self-conscious about it. Now I'm going to, like, really listen to him and be like, oh, so that's what you think of me?
All right, Susan, Kristen's on the line. We got some texts that are coming in. 312-981-7200. Let's stay on time. Let's take a quick break. We'll come back more with the worst here on 720 WGN. What's going down, y'all? All right, it's the worst here on the download every Tuesday night. Holly Laurent in studio. Longtime Chicagoan, improviser, was on the main stage at Second City, now lives out in beautiful Los Angeles, California. Hollywood.
Yeah.
Hollywood.
Yeah, baby.
You know, making us laugh with her genius. And she will be on stage at the Second City ETC tomorrow night with her longtime stage partner, Katie Rich. And they will be on stage at 8 o'clock. Virgin Daiquiri's opening up for them, and also a Chicago group of talented improvisers. It's fun to be back. I mean, to see all your friends and get a chance to get up on stage and improv.
The best. It's the best. It's like... to me, my parents moved too much, so I don't have a childhood home to go to where you feel that thing of like, oh, I just walked into the door of my house. But man, Second City is that for me. Walking in, family, just dysfunctional family where you love, hate.
You recognize
each other.
That? I mean, so many young people come through there. I mean, you walk in and you're like, everyone know who I am? And they're like, no, man. We're 19.
I know. And I'm like, that's what a 19-year-old looks like now? Goodness gracious.
All right, 312-981-7200. Let's go to the phones. Let's go to Susan. Susan, what's the worst?
Hi.
Hi.
I'm teaching art program for spring break this week.
Okay.
And yesterday the kids were supposed to cut out shapes to hang on a mobile. They're 4 and 5 years old.
Oh, uh-oh.
And none of them knew how to use the scissors. So I ended up cutting out 36 shapes.
Oh. Hand cramp.
You didn't even try to like let them just kind of figure it out. You're like, nah, I got to do this.
Well, I said they could rip it.
I like your style.
And when did they get to the glue? Is there glue involved?
Oh, of course.
Yeah.
They put some like tissue paper collage on there, and then we hung them up. But it was a trying day.
Susan, what I would do if I were you is I'd get a long leash. And I'd tie these kids together, and I'd walk them around the block for like for 25 minutes at least and just tire them out. I feel like that's what every daycare does in my block. Yeah. I see kids on leashes everywhere
I go.
Yeah,
kids on a rope.
Interesting. Yeah. Interesting.
So it's always an option. Thanks, Susan.
Sure.
All right, let's go to Kristen. Kristen, what's the worst, Kristen?
The worst was last week when we went to see Disney on Ice, and my husband got us a motel room that he stays in frequently when he goes in golf tournaments.
Okay. Wait, say that again? I didn't even hear it. I could barely make it out, so...
Oh, sorry.
There you go.
Husband got us a motel room that we could go to after we saw Disney on Ice, and we went in, and it was not good at all. And this was supposed to be a motel that had been, you know, totally renovated. It was just
really
expensive.
Bad hotel room.
Yeah, but then they put us in another one that was even worse.
Oh, no.
You went and complained? You said, hey, listen, this is bad. This is filthy. And they're like,
right, I did. I called Dan and I told them, and she said, oh, I'll be right up. So she came up and started taking pictures. She said, well, I'm going to put you in another room. Okay, let's go. So she did, and after she left, it was even worse.
Oh, no.
But by this time, it was midnight. We were tired. We slept in our sweats, and we couldn't even take a shower.
That's terrible. Oh.
That's
a straight up bum out.
Yeah.
You bummed us out, Kristen, with that one. That's no one likes a filthy hotel room.
Oh, you know what the dirtiest part of a hotel room is?
What's that?
The remote. Have you heard this?
Oh, I didn't. I don't want to know.
I know. That'll.
Is it a weird, creepy thing, or is it just because most people touch it?
It's just everybody.
Is that like some sort of fetish thing where people are doing things with the remote?
It's
and stuff,
a thing where
about?
You know people don't wash their hands. Their hands are. Yeah. But it's a thing that doesn't get cleaned.
They don't touch it. Right?
Everyone's touching. Yes. So now think of keep that in mind. That'll burn your noodle though, man.
One of the worst from a couple weeks ago was about. Someone found, it was like maybe it was a used prophylactic in the ice bin in a hotel.
Boy.
And then I was like, they don't clean that out either. Like, and then you go put the stuff in there. That's what I was like, all right.
And what if you're putting that ice in your drink?
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. All right, let's keep going. Let's go to Tanya. Tanya, what's the worst, Tanya?
Hi. Let me just start out by saying my three kids are pretty good. They've never gotten in trouble in school.
Okay, sure.
And today, just getting, not in trouble where I've gotten phone calls.
Okay.
But I had to go to my oldest daughter. She's a freshman in high school. And I guess she's giving her answers out to people. I get in trouble. She gets in trouble for that today because she said she doesn't know how to say no and people are asking for answers.
Like answers on a test kind of thing?
Yeah, like study guides because they don't want to do the homework and they know she's going to do it. So,
and she got caught doing that. That's the first problem. Go ahead.
Okay. Then my second daughter, I get an email because all the kids, she's selling slime at school. They're making slime and they're selling it at school.
Like she's making black market slime and getting 25 cents on
it's
the
like
dollar for that?
Cigarettes in prison. It's currency.
They make slime. They get glue and food coloring and they make all this slime, put it in baggies, and everyone's selling it at school. So there was a mass email out that a bunch of kids got in trouble. And
oh,
she came home and she didn't really get caught. She said, but she did sell slime for money. So I'm like, great. And then my son got in trouble for swearing on the bus.
Wow, triple threat tonight.
Yeah.
All three in one day. And I've never gotten phone calls before ever.
Tanya, right now you are leading in the vote total only for the fact that I want you to have a pizza so you can eat it in front of them and be like, this is punishment.
I know.
Get this pizza because you have, you get three different.
But the good news is these things happen in threes, so you're done.
Right.
Yeah, you got it all done.
That's all I have is three kids, thank God, right?
Yeah. I was going to say also the entrepreneurial spirit.
Yeah, I like it.
Is pretty strong in your family.
And
so I'll give
them
that.
I feel like at the end of the day, they still sound like good kids to me across the board.
Yeah.
Like these aren't real.
I swear they really are. They're really good kids. And my husband and I are like, this is crazy. And I just left for work. I'm going away for 2 days at the Hilton. And I just can't wait to go to work now. I just am so excited to go to the hotel. But I will check the remote. I'll definitely wipe the remote off now.
Yeah, the ice too.
Bring some wipes.
All right. Thanks, Tanya. That's good. Oh, that's a good one. Yeah. I feel like it's either these are good kids with entrepreneurial spirit or, just sort of a gateway.
That's right.
To a lot of other problems. But Tanya's going to figure that out, I'm sure. Let's go to Charlie. Charlie, what's the worst, Charlie?
The worst is back in 1988, we had a really bad summer. It was really hot.
I remember that, yeah.
Okay, and the wife, she went grocery shopping, and she got all these groceries. And about 2 weeks later, she comes out of work, and there's all these flies on the back end of the car. So she brings the car home. I open up the trunk, and what do I find? Two cornish hens, and a head of lettuce.
She just forgot
anyway,
about it.
Yeah, the flies didn't. We actually had to have the car actually, what do you call that, when they clean it out where you can't smell it.
Oh, wow. So you had some,
it didn't
some
work
expense
out so well.
To this.
Wow.
Yeah, it was just kind of the worst thing that I think I've ever.
And the best part, Charlie, is that in next year, it'll be a 30th anniversary. So you look back on that and say, it's been 30 years. This is
so
the 30 year the worst.
That's right.
Charlie, thanks for that, man. All right.
Okay, you're the phone. Okay, bye.
Bye. How about that? I think we're getting some good stuff tonight, Holly.
Yeah.
Listen to this.
Yeah,
All right. We're also getting a ton of texts as well, people calling in 312-981-7200. Let's take a break. We'll get an update on the news. We'll come back with the second half of the worst here on the download, 720 WGN.
What's going down, y'all? The worst come to my people, come first.
You know the worst come to the worst. When worst come to the worst, my people,
that's
come
bad,
first.
That's bad.
Come the worst. All right, thanks, Rob. It's the download here in 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. We got a lot of people standing by. Texts and calls to play the worst tonight, to complain about the worst things in society for prizes. Holly Laurent in studio. She is back for the Chicago Improv Festival. She's on stage tomorrow at Second City ETC at 8 o'clock with her longtime stage partner, Katie Rich, doing some improv for the Chicago Improv Festival. Holly, of course, improviser who was on the main stage at Second City, now living in Hollywood. Back in town. 312-981-7200. So we went through the first half. We've got some strong contenders, but there's still a lot more to play for the pizzas that were given away tonight. Mm-hmm. So let's get right to it.
I want some juicy ones.
Let's go to Valerie. Valerie, what's the worst, Valerie?
Hey.
Hey.
The worst was yesterday. I came back from vacation knowing that I had a ton of email.
Yeah.
So I go to log on to my computer, and my computer doesn't recognize me. So I have to log in as an other user. Then I can't get into my email.
Why doesn't it recognize you? What's the issue?
They don't know. They had to actually take my computer after trying to figure it out for a couple of hours in the morning. They took my computer and wiped it clean and started from fresh.
You gotta be kidding me.
I got my computer back this afternoon, and of course, you know, it doesn't have your signature in it anymore.
Doesn't have all the memes you collected. That sounds like the worst. There's a lot of sighs going on. Valerie, there's a lot of worse things in the world, though.
There are, but, you know.
It's a pain.
I wasn't able to do anything yesterday. I was just, oh, my God.
It's like an extension.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
It's an extension.
Yeah, but
it's an extension of your vacation. Look at it that way. Got an extra day.
Back in the office.
Back in the office. You got to work for a work from work day.
And no matter what happens when you come back from vacation, it's going to feel like garbage.
Yeah. So you got that out of the way.
Yeah.
Right?
That's true.
Yeah.
All right. Well, we're glad we could cheer you up, Valerie. We appreciate that.
Thanks.
Let's go to Julie. Julie, what's the worst, Julie?
Oh, 21 years ago, my daughter was just about 3 years old.
She's going to love this story.
Oh, you're going to love it. Yeah. We were having a housewarming party, and she was in her room taking a nap, and I went to get her up and realized that she had been awake for quite a while and had proceeded to remove her diaper and smear everything on the walls, the bed, herself, 10 minutes before the first guest was supposed to arrive at the new house.
Wow. Ooh. So did you get it cleaned up in time, or was that a cliffhanger?
Or did you lock the door and light a candle?
We thankfully, my mother-in-law was a big help. She says, I'll take her and get her cleaned up. I'm like, oh, thanks. Left me with the biggest mess, but we did get it cleaned up. I did have windows open, cleared everything out, and she survived and will be getting married in October this year.
Oh, this sounds like a story for the toast at the wedding.
Yeah, this has got wedding toast written all over.
I was thinking that, or I hope she has three daughters just like her.
I got that curse on me, too, from my mom. She always said, I hope you have a daughter just like you. And I haven't had children, and I wonder why.
I wonder why. All right,
my
thanks,
mother-in-law
Julie.
Used to say, I wish you have a son just like you. Yeah, I'm like, what did I ever do to you?
Ooh, getting it out. Yeah.
I love it, Julie. Thank you for that. 312-981-7200. All right. All right. Let's go to some of these texts. A lot have come in, so let me get these down. Okay. The worst. 262 says the head nod hello in the gym locker room. Does nobody cover up anymore? And that was the question mark and exclamation point at the same time. That's how I felt that it should be read, right?
I think up nods are the worst. I like a down nod. I don't like an up nod. Up nod is like, what's your
problem? Yeah, it's very bro-y.
Yeah.
What's up?
Don't give me an up
nod. What's up?
Yeah. You know what's the worst? When you let someone go in front of you in traffic and they don't give you the wave.
They don't give you
a wave. Give me the wave.
What about a head nod?
I'll take a down nod. Not an up nod.
If they give an up nod, do you follow them with the brights on?
I follow them and I beat them to a bloody pulp.
773 says the worst about shopping at Jewel, so specific, is when you wait a minute for that one lady to get off her phone only to see someone in front of what you need to purchase. Okay.
Too many people at the Jewel.
773, using an ATM and having the machine suck my money back in because I didn't retrieve it fast enough.
Oh, no.
That's on you.
Yeah, you got to pay attention. You got to
focus up. I don't know.
Focus
when money
up.
Comes out, you got to grab it.
What,
you got to put everything else. Yep. Put that stuff away. Money is on the table. Money is in the machine. Grab it.
Yeah.
I mean, if maybe this was a malfunctioning machine, but it feels like to me if that money is, if you see just the tip of the bill, you got to get your hands on it.
Uh-huh. That sweet, sweet cash. Get it while it's hot.
Get it while it's hot. All right. Okay. The worst is having to listen to the work. The worst is listening to the worst on the way to work. I should be heading home.
It's going to be a late night.
Yeah, that is. That's a weird. 773, water bottle leaking in my backpack, leaving a trail of green slime dripping, following me without my knowledge until three aisles were covered in Whole Foods.
Ooh, we know a little girl who could sell that slime. That's currency, dude. That's currency. Go mop that up.
She's in the Whole Foods.
Sell it on the elementary school market.
Shoveling it into a Ziploc bag. The worst is when the vet for April gets your hopes up about giving birth, but then you realize they've been saying that for 2.5 months. Talking about April the giraffe, which I agree. The worldwide phenomenon of a webcam on a pregnant giraffe, April, with the sort of idea that any day this giraffe's going to give birth and you could see it like in real time.
Yeah.
And it just stays pregnant for like longer than it should. So I think they're starting to be internet conspiracy theories that possibly it's a big hoax.
She just got gas.
I was watching this the other day, and I noticed they slapped a big Toys R Us ad on the bottom of the video
did
now.
Not.
Yeah, Toys R Us, because they have that toy giraffe, you know, that all the kids use. Yeah, Toys R Us.
That's the worst.
Yeah.
Wow. Have you ever seen a baby giraffe born? It's a long fall.
That's what everyone's waiting for.
Yeah, it's like bam, it falls from a height, and then it gets up right away.
It's ready to go.
Yeah, it's a prey animal. It's got to get ready to run.
6'3" It just takes off. The webcam is following after the little baby giraffe.
That, and there's a little girl following that. Like, is that slime?
Let me get that slime. The worst is voice recognition on my phone. All right, I guess. Yeah, I don't know. Yeah. 312 says the worst is when you have to bend down on a hot summer day and scoop up your dog's soft serve.
Mm.
That just seems like I don't know what the hot summer day has to do with it.
Also, what are you feeding it? This is fixable.
This is fixable.
Yeah.
You could fix that worse.
Yeah. You can get that nice and hard.
Right. The worst, 630, this is a tough one. The worst is getting dumped after making hotel reservations for the both of you.
True. How'd you get dumped? That's what I want to know. We want the juicy details.
Was it a text dump?
Yeah, that's the worst. Any dump is
did
bad.
Did you get dumped on Expedia? Like while you're making the hotel reservations? Yeah, that was dumb. That didn't make sense. The worst about shopping in suburban stores, slow music, making people meander. Stop meandering. All right, yeah. Let's go to Marcos. Marcos, what's the worst, Marcos?
Me and my wife were waiting in line at Walmart, and they shut down the lines to two or three cashiers out of like 20 per cash registers, out of 20 cash registers. We waited in line for 15 minutes around midnight. We get to our cashier, and he says he's on break, and he just walked away.
Oh.
He's mad.
Yeah, and the manager's kind of arguing with him. He's like, on break. He just walked away. He's kind of stuck. Yeah.
Man. Oh, that sucks.
That guy's fighting for his rights.
Thanks, Marcos. Yeah, that is tough, man. And that is, I mean, there is obviously an issue that the budgets or whatever it is that run the late night Walmarts or the Targets or whatever, they have not figured it out where they're like, one guy's going to work tonight. Let's just have one guy. It's like you go in there for one thing at midnight and you're like, I just need to get one thing. And you're in the line is the longest you've ever seen it.
I know. It makes you think about stealing.
Don't get me started.
They made me steal it. The line was too long.
At a certain point, I think a judge would understand that.
Yeah.
You're like, you know what? No, I've been there.
Yeah.
I wanted that orange juice too. And it's good.
How long was this break? We're talking 15 or 30?
We didn't know.
A 30-minute break? Yeah, I would have stole it too.
312 wants to know, the worst is when you run for the elevator that's closing and you finally pry the doors open with your jaws of life bare hands and everybody's not looking at you pretending like they're doing the mannequin challenge.
When you said bare hands, I pictured that he has bare hands. He's a human like body, but bare hands. Like what, a black bear? A grizzly bear? That's why everyone's don't see you.
They're playing dead.
Yeah.
I think it's a bear attack.
Exactly. Oh. Play that.
That's great.
That's why.
And that is improv.
Yeah, that's the worst, when you have bare hands. That would be the worst.
Oh, that's good stuff. 312-981-7200. All right, we'll come back. We'll get Mike. We'll get the text as well. And we're gonna crown some winners, pizza winners.
Great.
Holly Loren in studio. We're playing the worst. Stay with us.
Going down,
come the worst 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 come the worst
All right, it's the worst. 312-981-7200. Holly Loren in studio. She's in the Improv Fest, Chicago Improv Fest at Second City ETC. Tomorrow night, 8 o'clock with Katie Rich. Virgin Daiquiri's opening up. Yes. It's a big show. Yeah. Back in town. Yeah. Holly, of course, longtime Chicago improviser with The Reckoning, also with Second City Main Stage. Awesome that you told me in the break that The Reckoning performs out in L.A. every Thursday night.
Mm-hmm. With Cook County Social Club, that's great. Also Chicago Classic.
Great groups and from Chicago that are in L.A. that are...
Yeah, we're bringing the Chicago style.
Entertaining the masses.
That's right.
In Hollywood. 312-981-7200. Let's go to Mike. Mike, what's the worst, Mike?
The worst is basically trying to quit smoking, and you can smell cigarettes everywhere around you. It's like a superpower because I've quit smoking for like 3 months, and my senses are returning, like you have to taste, my taste and smell. But I can, like, you know, I can spot
right
when people are smoking, like, you know, a half a block away, like that guy down the street just lit up a Newport cigarette.
That's the downside. You get your senses back, and now all you can sense is cigarette smoke.
Right. I can't smell a fire down the block, but in Newport, I can smell. That's pretty much it.
Now that there is a parliament. Yeah. Ooh, somebody's got a camel.
That's a cool one. I don't like that. Yes, cool.
All right, thanks, Mike. That's great. That's a good one.
Keep it up. Keep it up.
Yeah,
stick
good luck.
With it.
Stick with it. All right. 773 says the worst is going to McDonald's and saying your order slow so they get it right, and yet they still get it wrong.
Oh.
Yeah, I guess. 773, being out of toilet paper. Mm. Classic.
Yeah.
That's for the worst when we do the best of the worst.
Yeah.
Nobody's it's always toilet, argue with that one. Oh, toilet paper themed.
Yeah.
Always. The worst is when carefully... 312. The worst is when people carefully pick the crud out of the corner of their eyes and examine it like rare rubies.
Oh, don't look at it.
It's eye snot, people. Gross. That's a good one. The worst is when the cops wait till you get in a difficult spot before pulling you over.
Mm.
Yeah, they want to make it as...
They just wait till you get good and drunk.
Yeah.
It's on them, man. That's on them.
Those cops.
They made you do it. They just gave you long enough to get hammered. How dare they?
How dare you? 773, the worst saran wrapping anything. I'm a terrible saran wrapper.
It's an art form.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I've seen some really good saran wrapping. Some tight saran wrapping, but I can't do it.
When you got it, you got it. You can bounce a quarter off that.
It's like when it was high school and I would roll the jeans. It's never really good at rolling the jeans.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I way too loose. Way too cash and loose.
It's not a loose roll, Justin. Yeah. It's a tight roll.
I know. Or just too tight. Like, I couldn't get it right.
Mm,
not my thing.
You're a man of extremes.
Yeah, that's right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's right. All right. Why don't 630 says a joke for my 4-year-old. Why don't bears wear socks? They have bare feet.
Hey.
See, there you go. That was based on.
It's a callback. That's what we call a callback.
That's a callback. Mm-hmm. 773, the worst cash-only businesses. Okay. The worst are extremely tiny pockets.
Yeah.
On jeans that aren't big enough for your phone.
Yeah, or your hand. And then your hand is all the way out and just the fingernails are in.
It was like at some point they're like, that's great for quarters.
Right.
You know, people had loose change and it just stuck with it. Like somewhere there is a mass of people like that we don't even know that are using it for coins.
Uh-huh.
And they have the data at jeans companies and they're like, you don't get it. You know, you're the minority. You don't understand. But this is in the heartland.
Oh.
People are using, they're using it for nickels, for dimes. You just don't get it.
I haven't seen a nickel or dime in a real long time, man.
It's a Hollywood living, man. You don't deal with the small stuff.
That's right.
All right. The worst is listening to the worst while getting ready for an 8 a.m. flight home from Frankfurt, Germany. Greetings from Germany.
Hey.
All right. That doesn't sound like the worst. It sounds awesome.
Dankeschön. Bitte schön.
Right. All right. Mary from Roselle says, when the ATM makes the sound that will give you the money, then the door doesn't open.
Mm-hmm.
No money, then 30 minutes arguing with the bank manager that you didn't get it.
Oh, man.
Now, that bank manager's really putting his foot down.
Yeah. Well,
That's their job, right?
Yeah, I guess so.
Argue over the ATM.
Yeah. At least she was ready. If it did come out, she would have grabbed
right.
it.
She would have right
with
away.
With her hot little bare hand.
773, the worst is t-shirts that look totally normal and plain until you spot the tiny embroidery that says something completely random. Yeah. All right. Killing it on the t-shirt. There's a lot of t-shirt stuff tonight, too. 773, being jealous of Jay Cutler's bum.
Huh.
I don't know if you saw that today. You were on the plane.
No, what happened?
Jay Cutler, Kristen Cavallari, a Cavallari, sorry, excuse me, her husband, her wife, his, whatever.
Oh, boy.
Anyway, Instagram vacation picture where Jay Cutler is naked from behind.
Oh.
So it's Jay Cutler's bum on display.
Can you do that on Instagram?
It was funny because she actually put a post. I think everybody had to screenshot it and put it on every People Magazine, People.com.
So how was it?
It was good.
It was good.
It was strong. It was a strong bum.
Nice. Was it real? Was it white? Did it have lines?
I think, the whole point. Like, no tan lines.
Oh.
Like, it was a really strong bum. I got to say, I give Jay Cutler a lot of credit.
Okay.
He gets a bad rap for how he plays football. But I got to say, in the bum department, not so bad.
Yeah. Bad knees, right? Bad knees, good bum?
Yeah, bad knees. Really can't read a 3-4 defense, but I mean, good bum.
Wasn't he the one that was injured forever?
Yeah, he's always injured. Everything.
Oh, yeah.
He's gone. He's out of Chicago. He's been gone for too long, Holly. He's gone.
Oh.
But he's got a great bum.
I like that Cubs pitcher who was naked in ESPN.
Jake Arrieta, right?
Yeah.
Right.
That was a good bum.
Strong bums.
I didn't see no tan lines on that one, neither. How these guys getting their bums?
All right. So many great athletic bums. Now that means something completely different. But anyway, 312-981-7200. All right, you know what? Let's wrap it. Let's wrap and give away some prizes, right?
Yeah.
All right, what'd I do with it? Well, here it is. A Lou Malnati's gift certificate. I got two of them tonight. Lou Malnati's, home of the Chicago's best deep dish pizza. Find one of their 40-plus Chicagoland locations or order online at loumalnati's.com. We got two. This is tough because, when you're only giving away two prizes, there's so much stuff tonight. There was so much great stuff.
Yeah.
But let's go right to it. And we're going to pick two from the phones tonight. The texts have been great.
Yeah.
And you know what? Keep them coming.
But we had to follow
our
hearts.
We had to follow. I think if one pizza tonight is going to go to Charlie.
Yeah.
Because back in 1988, Charlie's wife left two Cornish hens in the back of their car on a very, very hot summer in Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
Took them a couple weeks to notice. The flies noticed first. And Charlie had to get the car cleaned out it professionally. So there's actually a cost to that. Not only did they not eat the Cornish hens, but there was a cost to clean the car.
Yeah.
So we feel to make up for the Cornish hens from 30 years ago, you can have a pizza.
A pizza today.
A pizza today for the Cornish hens from 30 years ago.
The memory of the hens that weren't.
That's right. And tonight, our number one, who's also going to get a pizza, is Tanya, who's back in the line. Tanya, her three kids, usually the best kids of all time, all separately in trouble tonight. Schools either calling or emailing to tell you about your bad family.
I know, it's terrible.
It's terrible, but you got a couple days to get away for work, and now you get a Lou Malnati's gift certificate.
Yeah.
I suggest, Tanya, that you order this, you get this gift certificate, you order the pizza, and you eat it in their presence and not let them have any as punishment.
I should, because they love stuffed pizza. So that is a great idea.
Yes.
See? And you can say, this is from Uncle Justin.
This was a lot of fun. I really appreciate it.
Tanya, thanks so much for playing. All right. A great night tonight. Holly Laurent in studio and on stage tomorrow at Second City ETC. Back just this week for the Chicago Improv Festival 20th anniversary. Holly, I can't thank you enough. Great to see you. Thanks for being here.
My pleasure. Thank you so much. I get to look out these windows at my beautiful Shy.
All right, that's going to do it tonight. Patty Vasquez up next. This is Chicago's very own 720 WGN Chicago, WGNRadio.com.